Good.
Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in to listen to the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies that nobody else wants to talk about. This is episode number 37, and my name's Al Pacino. Sorry, my name's Jakob.
And my name's Nicolo.
My name's Jack.
And I'm Alina. I'm finally back.
Great stuff. Okay, super happy to have you all with us here. As you can possibly see, we've got someone who's been absent for a while. Alina, by the way, how are you? Because it's been a while.
I'm good. Just really freaking busy trying to wrap up TIFF stuff and planning all this Halloween content we have coming out, but having lots of fun, losing a lot of sleep, though.
And spending 12 hours watching the Godfather films.
Yeah, back to back to back to back, pretty much.
Yeah, amazing. So let's just do this, because I think you're like a balloon bursting with knowledge and opinion about the Godfather film. So let's just do it. So last week we basically spent 2 hours retelling all the funny scenes from Popstar, Never Stop, Never Stopping. So go on and listen to that. And today, I don't think my conversation will be this wild, but you never know. Anyway, what we are talking about today is Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather Part 3.
I'm a businessman, first foremost. I want no further conflict with him.
Will you tell him from me that he can live or he can die?
Vincent, will you shut up?
Directed by Francis Ford Coppola and co-written with Mario Puzo. Mario Puzo, I think that's his name, is right? The Godfather Part 3 finds Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, in 1978, I think it is, as he is desperately attempting to deliver on his promise to his ex-wife Kay, played by Diana Keaton, from way back in the first film, and tries to take the Corleone family out of any criminal business. As he is trying to take a controlling interest in an international conglomerate with a lot of sway from the Catholic Church, he also has to deal with various dramas inside his own family. Like, his son doesn't want to have anything to do with the family. He wants to be an opera singer. His daughter Maria, played by Sofia Coppola, falls in love with his illegitimate nephew Vinny, played by Andy Garcia, and many secrets from the past are slowly percolating to the surface to stage Michael Corleone's long coming judgment day. Now, the idea to make the third Godfather film dates back all the way to like 1974, when after the release of the critically acclaimed Part 2, Coppola and Puzo felt the story wasn't done. It needed kind of like an epilogue. So anyway, however, immediately after the film got released, he kind of bogged himself down, as in Coppola bogged himself down in the hellscape of trying to adapt Joseph Conrad's The Heart of Darkness into what we know as Apocalypse Now, which must have drained him considerably. And also after the massive failure of One from the Heart, Coppola didn't enjoy too much confidence among studio moguls. So that didn't really help him make this sort of film come true. Finally, in the late 80s, they agreed to make the movie and got most of the original cast together, without Bobby Duvall, who I think they fell out over money. So I think he wanted to be paid as much as Al Pacino, and the studio said no. But we might as well get to it at some point anyway. And naturally without people whose characters were no longer alive. So they pulled this one last hurrah. However, as it turns out, the studio meddled quite a bit with this movie, and but eventually saw the light of day. It kind of didn't receive much fanfare, and The Godfather Part 3 was criticized for its convoluted plot and alleged widespread nepotism, mostly aimed at his daughter Sofia, whom he cast in arguably one of the most important roles. And we'll get to it, I suppose. And so the film kind of laid forgotten for nearly three decades, though Coppola made changes to it for a home release and added some exposition to the front to make the plot more understandable. I don't think it helped. until he got to the go-ahead from the studio after years of nagging, I suppose, to recut and re-edit the film without actually shooting any new footage, I think, to give The Godfather 3 a tone of a true epilogue. So some scenes were excised, some were trimmed, some moved to imbue even more symmetry to The Godfather original sort of, and the sequel. And the movie was released under a mouthy title, The Godfather, Coda, colon, The Death of Marco Corleone, late last year, which is now understood as the version of the movie to watch by the filmmaker, the critics, and the general audiences. Alina can testify, because, you know, like, she's been told repeatedly by people on Twitter, this is the one to watch, not the theatrical. So so let's begin our deliberations by asking a simple question and sort of talking about our initial impressions. So I don't want us to divide it into the two parts about, like, the theatrical versus Coda. Let's just talk about these two films kind of simultaneously and just, like, weave in and out, kind of like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino bits in Godfather Part 2. But where do you stand on the third Godfather? So what is your take on this movie? How about Alina? You lead the way.
Okay, so before yesterday, I had not seen of the Godfather movies before. Like, I literally only signed up for this episode because I was like, okay, I can finally bully myself into watching these movies. Let's go. So I watched the first and second one yesterday, and then I watched the third one twice this morning because I watched the recut afterwards. And, like, I honestly don't understand why the third one is hated. It is. Like, I tweeted that I was gonna watch all the Godfather movies, and, like, all these random dudes that don't follow me and I don't follow them, why do they always reply to my tweets or saying, like, oh, you should definitely watch all two Godfather movies or watch the re-edit? And I'm like, did I ask you? Leave me alone. And, like, they're wrong. It's a fine movie. Like, watching the theatrical cut and the re-edit, like, back to back, it generally does not feel that different. Like, it's slightly improved, but it's really not that big of a difference. So, like, why is everyone so worked up about it? It's weird.
It's just some startling opening lines. Jack, do you want to follow up on this?
Yeah, I'm just eating. Well,
or do you want Nicola to go first and you just finish eating?
No, I can go. We spoke about this, like, very briefly on the top 100 list. These three films were always on my bucket list to watch. I remember buying the DVDs, the special editions, years ago. And I watched the first one, and obviously it's a masterpiece in its own right. And I watched the second one on the famous DVD, which is, like, got the intermission in, and you have to put on the second disc, like, the fucking good old times of cinema. And unlike Alina, I didn't really have anyone, like, pushing me to watch the third one. And I'd heard mixed things, and I think the negativity usually overcrowds something like that, so I put off it a little bit. And it was only, like, maybe 6 months later where they brought out the Coppola restoration, which is going to be, like, a theme running through this podcast. You know, it's got a brand new restoration. It wasn't 4K, but Coppola had gone in, cleaned it up a little bit with the cinematography as well, which is incredibly dark as the sequels go on, specifically the second one. And I watched the third one, I think I was showing my family, and I thought it was really, really enjoyable. It has its issues, which we'll talk about, but it's a product of its time as well, in 1990 specifically. Again, like, the issue is, like, what people raise is Sofia Coppola, which, like, I don't blame him for this. Isn't he chose to go with her after what happened with Winona Ryder, which I'm sure we'll talk about as well. I think out of a really difficult situation, because this film is made purely out of financial issues with his studio, again, which we'll talk about, I feel like he did a really good job with the issues he had at hand. It is a step down from two features before it, the predecessors, but they are the zeitgeist of cinema, specifically the first one. And what he did with the second one is incredibly impressive for the era. He was always going to be doomed to make this. I always feel, and there's always, like, a conversation of him wanting to go and make another one. I think when Mario Puzo was alive, they wanted to, and I said this on a podcast as well, they wanted to do a fourth one where it was a prequel where, like, James Caan, Sonny's character, was played by Leonardo DiCaprio. This is Gangs of New York time, the early 2000s. And then they would look at Andy Garcia in the future. After this film, should I say. I find that really interesting. I don't think it will ever get made, but I find it interesting. I find this interesting. I think Sofia Coppola's generally quite really good for what she does here. But yeah, it's a step down, but it's not a step down in the way of like sheer quality. It's not like watching something like, fuck no, you know, you watch two films, how gonna, like, you know, like when you watch like, the first two Star Wars films and you watch Return of the Jedi, there's like a disconnect. You don't really know why. I think it's a maturity of a filmmaker. Different because obviously George Lucas didn't direct that one. Ivan Kershaw did, but
Return of the Jedi was Richard Marquand.
The second one, didn't I? Was it Richard?
Richard Marquand did the third one, and Ivan Kershaw did the second one.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, point so remains of it with the lack of George Lucas involved. I think it's difficult because if he would have handed this film off to a director, I think it would have prospered. But the fact is that if you've had this babe and it grows up and it becomes a family, you want to sort of take control of it and raise it on your own. And I don't know, I think in hindsight probably wasn't the best thing to do, but it's his property, and I don't blame him for wanting to take complete control. But again, my initial thoughts when I first saw it, I was like impressed. I really enjoyed it. What would you call it? Re-edit, director's cut, coda. I don't think it solves anything as well. I think I'm on the same page as you, just very, very briefly. I don't think it solves major issues, because issues are fundamental that are in this film. You can't take them out. You can't edit them. So I have my own issues with that. And I wrote a feature on that as well at Clapper, which I got into, but again, I'm sure we'll talk about. Again, it doesn't change anything. I really like it. I have a newfound appreciation for the film, which I hope many other people do. It looks astonishing, and the fashion sense in the third Godfather film is so fucking good. It's unbelievable. Especially like everything that Sofia Coppola wears, like that's Met Gala stuff now. Like it's really strange, especially the suits and stuff. But again, that's fashion, like the cyclical nature of it. But again, I'll be the same. I really enjoyed them both when I was younger. Really like them now. I watch all three of them at Christmas with my family. It's just a tradition. And like Alina said, I don't understand why the third one gets so much shit. It just feels like it's a film bro thing to say now, you know? Or like the third Godfather shit because people are being programmed to say it. People need to think for themselves. I'm glad Alina's, you know, striving the cause anyway.
Nicole, do you want to follow up?
What's your take? I have an interesting history with the Godfather series because I watched the first one when I was, I want to say 11, I think. Generally changed my way that I approach cinema, and I loved it. I've seen it at least 10 times since. The second one I watched when I was like 13, because we rented it at the library. I watched it. I was like, this was good, you know, and I hadn't seen it since. And this year I was doing a whole director's retrospective, and I chose Francis Ford Coppola. And so I ended up watching finally The Godfather Part 3 for the first time, almost like 8 years after I saw the second one, because of everything that Alina talked about, because everyone is like, it's not good. It's not worth it. Sophia sucks in the film. Don't watch it. I was like, okay, whatever. I don't want to waste 3 hours of my life watching something that's not good. then I watched the film and I loved it. And I watched the coda version first. And then in preparation for this one, I rewatched the entire trilogy, checking out the theatrical version of Godfather Part 3. And I honestly, it might be very controversial, but I prefer this to the second one. I honestly really love this film, even with all its blatant flaws. This is lovely. This is pure cinema. I love the trajectory that Michael Corleone's story goes through. I love that it's a film about redemption, and it's a redemption that's denied to him. He cannot really fully atone for his sins. In an almost spiritual sense, yes, but in an earthly way, no. It's a very tragic film. It's very operatic. It literally has one of the best climaxes set during the opera that I've seen. And it's just pleasant. And we will get into the differences of the two cuts, but I have to agree that the new version is better, mainly because it's tighter, because it does last 20 minutes shorter, which I think is the only problem of the longer cut of the theatrical one, which is just way too long. You do feel the length at 3 hours, but I don't feel the changes, honestly, which is weird. I cannot tell which scenes were actually removed from one version.
I mean, hold on, it's only 4 minutes shorter.
Is it really?
Theatrical was 162, and this one was 158. But it feels like a lot has been lopped off.
It does. It really does.
Yeah, I mean, okay, well, if we're all going through our personal history with the Godfather series, I might as well just chip in. Like, I think am I the only person here who's read the book first?
I read the book after watching the first two.
Because I mean, this is one of those things, like, I suppose, like, I could, if I remember correctly, this is something that probably my dad would have probably just told me to read, because he probably saw me going through, like, Stephen King books when I was, like, 13, 14, and he was like, why are you reading this shit? Read this. And he gave me The Godfather, just read this. I'm like, okay. And it was, like, an old copy that we had in the house, you know, so it was just all kind of, the paper was kind of yellowish already because it was, like, bought in the 60s or so, or something like this. Or the 70s, because I think it was released in, like, 1969 or something like that. And it just blew my mind. And then I watched the film and it blew my mind. And it's one of my favorite personal favorites. But the third one is well, I've always kind of been like this, that especially that you always watch them in succession. As in, you watch the first one, second one, and then the third one. You can't watch them out of order because they're kind of like, you know, that's the type of trilogy you're watching. So, but to me, easily the sort of the burnout sets in as you're watching the third one. So you're almost kind of just immediately almost like you're geared towards not liking it that much because you're tired. But if you now kind of just spread it apart, just to give yourself like a day of break between these films, it actually looks like I don't want to be controversial, but I think I like it a little bit more than the second one as well. But that's mainly because the third one the second one is just so long. Even on the Blu-ray, it still has the intermission. Like, it's just like, what am I supposed to do? Just go and have a piss while this is running? It's just, yeah, this is just ridiculous. Especially, well, for this recording, I watched Dakota because I've seen the third one theatrical a few times already. And so I think I know it quite well. And it actually, yeah, I understand why they wanted to make the film, because if you actually watch the second one and you see how it ends, it kind of ends almost on a cliffhanger. It kind of almost ends as though like you're like, okay, so what next? What's going to happen? So you kind of need the third one, and it's almost a bit of a travesty that they waited like 16 years. They had to wait 16 years to actually make it happen. But even with the restoration and with the coda now re-edited, kind of to be a bit more sort of, I don't want to say romantic, but kind of sort of trimmed down and a little bit less sort of reliant on the plot. I think it kind of just works like that. That almost has this sort of quality that, like, when I've always seen this as a 90s film, because it kind of looks like it's made in the 90s. But now with the restoration and with, I don't know what they've done to it, but it kind of feels like a film from the 70s almost. Like, it feels like they've kind of accomplished this job that it's just, if you can convince yourself that Michael Corleone is, well, that these actors haven't aged that much, because I think they've aged more than they should have as characters. Maybe they haven't, because it was 50s. Maybe it's appropriate. Maybe it is appropriate. But anyway, I like it quite a lot, and I really enjoyed watching this, especially now. It feels final. It feels amazing, and the ending of the film is finally just. And I know I think it's just trimmed in a few places, but it just comes together almost as good as the ending of the first film. It's just it has the sort of finality that the first one. Well, first one has finality, but it's almost like an ambiguous finality when the door closes on Kay, and then you just see how Michael Corleone ascends to the throne. That's a different sort of finality. But this thing, even though they changed the fact that he doesn't technically die in the coda because he doesn't fall off the chair, it feels as though it's like, I think we're done here. Like you see his face, you see how tired he is with everything and how he's almost failed in doing what he was supposed to do. I mean, he failed because he let his daughter die. But apologies to anyone who hasn't seen The Godfather Part 3. I don't know what you're doing listening to this, but you should have watched it. But yeah, I really, really like it. So I think we're all in the same sort of in the same boat on this. So because I think we've, like, Jack and Nicola, you've already danced around this a little bit. So how about we just get to the elephant in the room? It's like, what's the issue with the film? As in, because then it wasn't really received well. I think people kind of just accused Coppola of being is it called a nepotist? I don't know. Is there some word? Like, what's the problem? And is the problem a real problem? What's going on?
Can I start? Because I think...
Sure.
I don't think it's an issue with the film per se. I think it's actually Coppola. And the issue where it starts is, like, after the first Godfather, I think he was touted to make the second one. Didn't want to do it out of spite for them trying to fire him every second on the first production. Did it because he wanted the pay, and also didn't want anyone to tarnish his reputation. He'd rather ruin his own, which I quite admire. Then he went to make The Conversation, and he made a deal with Paramount that if he directed The Godfather Part Two, he would do two things. He would write The Great Gatsby remake, or he would write a film about The Great Gatsby, and then he would write a biopic about Patton, the war commander. And I think, well, obviously both of them, Paramount said yes, both of them were greenlit, both of them were made. And then he made The Conversation, and then he was the 70s god, and then he went on to make Apocalypse Now, which ruined his life and ruined his career. And from that moment, from 1979, when it was released, or when it was shown at Cannes, from that moment forward, he's always tried to make something different, like with, you know, The Outsider and Rumblefish as well, which are two very interesting pieces of work, but not The Godfather. And it's interesting, like, that as time goes on, he makes a company of George Lucas, which is, I think, is American Zoetrope, is that how it's pronounced? Which is then changed to Zoetrope Productions.
I think it's American Zoetrope. I mean, is it Zoetrope? Yeah.
I think it's Zoetrope.
Zoetrope, yeah.
Which goes into financial buckled because they can't make any money off anything he's making, like The Outsiders, like Rebel Fish, the Jeff Bridges thing with the electric car. I can never remember what it's called. Is it something Carlson? I don't know why Tucker Carlson's like fucking. Jesus Christ, I almost frightened me to death when I said that. Then it might appear if you say it four more times. But none of his features are making money, and then Paramount come to him, and he has a choice. American Zoetrope either buckles under the pressure and it disintegrates, or he makes a Godfather Part Three. And to save his own ass and to save his company, he makes the film. Right, that's bad pretenses to make it. If you're going to make a financial decision to make a film of which they're mandating certain things, you're fucked. You're not going to win the game. You're not. And the issues just go from there. He taps Winona Ryder, who's just gone off making a string of films, who's got quite clearly issues of, I can't remember the medical term for it, but it's pure exhaustion.
All right. So she wasn't like addicted to anything.
No. She had exhaustion. Right, I can't remember if she'd made Girl Interrupted, or maybe it's too early.
Girl Interrupted is like well in the 90s, no?
She'd made a film where she was like physically exhausted, and she even arrived in Rome.
Was it Reality Bites? No, Reality Bites.
I can't remember what it was, but she signed on. Everyone went to go start shooting in Rome. Robert Duvall wanted more money to play the lead against Michael. That was scrapped. The Paramount were refusing to there. There's an anecdote that Robert Duvall says in this book I own, and Francis Ford Coppola went to go meet him, and they had dinner, and Coppola refused to talk about the film, just wanted to see his friend, and Duvall wanted to talk about the film, and the only thing they could muster have a conversation about was a recipe of some spaghetti bolognese, I think, which in hindsight is quite funny, but also quite sad. So Duvall's out the picture. John Cazale has died almost, in 1979?
He's died, yeah, quite shortly after the second one.
Yeah, exactly.
cancer.
Exactly. So, there's multiple issues. If you watch the end
of Cazale couldn't come back because he was dead.
But there's multiple issues of the ingredients that's not now there anymore. And if you watch the second Godfather at the end, right at the end when the leaves turn brown and Michael's in his boathouse, if you look very closely, he has old age makeup on. That is the end of the series at the second film.
He was supposed to have old age makeup because the film was made 2 years after the first one, but he's supposed to be like 10 years older.
No. The final scene is when he's a lot older, like he's in his 80s. Right.
Okay. The final shot, you mean? Okay.
Yeah. So, again, like...
I thought it was just like the taxi driver that it's almost like in your mind's eye that he just grows old.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, David Bowie on the sofa.
But to get to the point, that to build on false pretenses and to build without passion is a very dangerous recipe. And if the ingredients are not there, Winona Ryder goes there, she's there for 2 days, she can't get out of bed, she's physically and mentally exhausted. He has to get Sophia to do it, has no acting experience. Who, how that conversation...
I beg your pardon, she has acting experience. She played the baby who was baptized in the first one. Yeah,
she's MCU, she had a cameo, they filtered it in. Coppola was so ahead of his time.
She was in Peggy Sue Got Married as well.
And she was in the second one as an immigrant child somewhere in the Ellis Island.
On the boat, Wasn't she on the boat? When she's in Ellis Island.
No. But yeah, she's on the boat. So she's there.
Well, she's
a learned, experienced actress.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just to have, I would love to be on the fly on the wall when that conversation at the vineyard, for him to convince her to do that. I would just love to have known how that would have gone, because I bet that would have been a really tough conversation to have. But regardless, this film is made out of money. It comes out in the wrong era, 1990, which is the Goodfellas era, which is Scorsese's. This film is not a Godfather film. It's just not. It's a meld of trying to brood itself with the Godfather formula, but it's very much in the vein of trying to emulate Goodfellas.
Wow.
And another issue is I find it? That... Yeah, specifically the helicopter scene, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But one other thing that this annoys me about Coppola, and this is more so a wider topic, is that it's not just the one odd case that this happens where he has to make a film for money. He's also done it with Apocalypse Now, doing a third edit, which didn't need to happen whatsoever. And when these things start dropping out of nowhere, that you have to pay quite close attention. Because then what happens is that all of a sudden, Godfather Part 3 Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone, it is now going to be in cinemas for 3 days only, and it's going to have a new edit on digital purchase. And thinking, okay, this is very strange. And then merely 4 weeks after that's announced, Coppola announces his science fiction venture that he wants to get backing for. That's what really annoys about the second edit. It's not made out of any passion.
But he's making this for his own money as well.
Is
it Metropolis or what is it called?
Megalopolis.
Megalopolis, right? I thought he was supposed to bankroll it himself, just sell the vineyards and just bankroll it, just have this sort of one last sort of hurrah and then die.
He's made a lot of money in it. You know, £4,000 a gift basket, or $5,000, maybe $6,000. But this is a thing. It's like, if he had passion for The Godfather Part 3, he wouldn't have made it. It's simple as that.
I think it might maybe one of those sort of, it's like you have this something in your throat that just bothers you. It's like, it's kind of like, I should have done this a bit differently. I fucked it up. Let's do it.
American Zoetrope ended in 1990. The financial returns of the film did not help him survive that company.
It made money, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't. Well, to bankroll whatever he wanted to do, I just think that I'm glad we've got the edit, but it's just like the final cut thing with Apocalypse Now. Unfortunately, I'm a firm believer in that when something comes out and it's released and you release it in that mindset, you have to let it go. You have to release it, and then it doesn't become yours anymore. It becomes the audience's, the viewers. However bad that is, or however that's taken, unfortunately, that's how it is. You've got to let it go. You've got to cut it at the umbilical cord and keep on going back to it and back to it. For example, I'll name one thing. Like, the George Lucas thing on Star Wars is downright ridiculous. The fact that he had to go in there and do that is downright ridiculous. But he owns those films. That's his issue. Coppola must have made a deal with Paramount and with Studio Canal. The only time where I think you should go in is in retrospect, if something has happened where it feels socially and politically correct to do so. For example, not to bring it back to the Matrix, but it's quite difficult. I know, just bear with me. It's quite difficult to watch.
Hold on, let me quote William Friedkin. Who gives a shit?
No. My point is, like, this is the only time where I think you should go back and edit a proper set. Is that I find that when the 20th anniversary was in 2019, I watched it from Chicago, right?
Mm.
And it's still got, this is a new restoration, it still has their dead names on that property, which I think is vile. I know you can be like, well, it's made in a certain time and I might contradict myself, but I think that's genuinely quite vile. There's such easy things to change, and I'm pretty sure the directors would welcome that. That would make a more ethical change within the system, specifically in Hollywood. Going back to fucking add 40, 50 minutes to a film that's 3 hours long, I think is borderline. Well, I'm not going to say that, but it's just borderline ego. And the fact of the matter is, like, he does this quite a lot. And the fact that he announces this film, which is never going to get made. It's never going to get made. Who's going to bankroll it? Who is going to have the money to bankroll that film? It's going to cost, what, up to $200 million to do? There's no way he could make that for less than $100 million, my opinion. Therefore, to make these edits or make partnerships with these edits, I think it comes out of a place of financial, almost greed. Are we going to see the conversation, deleted scenes added on next? Are we going to watch Twitch with the next hour of uncut footage? It sets a very strange precedent to make it purely out of money. And that's the relationship I have with Coppola at the moment. For someone who's an archetype of industrial cinema, who came from San Francisco Film School with the likes of George Lucas and stuff like that, and has made zeitgeist transcending films, I think for someone then to come back and to go...
He manufactured the new Hollywood together with Scorsese.
Yeah, and De Palma.
De Palma, Spielberg, you know, Lucas, all these people. Yeah, so he's...
I know you think it's a slight irony that two of them, who are major foundations, have gone back and re-edited major properties that influence the zeitgeist.
I mean, two, three, right?
Who would you say the third one is?
Spielberg.
Well, are you talking about the E.T. thing?
Yeah. He did that,
yeah,
didn't he?
I mean, I can understand why they would do that, but again, I think...
Oh, and also he changed the title to Raiders of the Lost Ark.
For me, just leave it. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, yeah, but you don't need to edit these things. That's the first thing I have issue with the film.
Is that just the first issue?
No. I'm just a firm believer. If you create something, if you create art, there's a point where you have to let it go. And as much as that's difficult because you pour passion, you pour your own humanity in it, you pour yourself in it, it takes a slice of you and it grows on this piece, and you have to let it go and let someone else dictate what it is, to analyze it, to contextualize it, to recontextualize it. To go back to something and to continually mess with something brings that into disrepute, in my opinion. Now, am I glad we've got an edit of Coda, whatever you want to call it? Yes and no. I think it for the film itself is a fine property. I don't think it's as detriment as what other people say. Why he would decide to call it the name and then at the end, to which I think is a very interesting idea that you alluded to earlier, to not showcase Michael fall off the chair. I don't know what that's sort of trying to project, if that's ambiguity, if that's... Is it that's his own insecurity of not being able to kill that character? I don't know. I think the death of Michael Corleone, the fact that he's a dead man walking, like, I understand that. But he is after Fredo. Like, it's, I get that. Mm-hmm. I think most other people do. So for me, I just don't understand why you'd want to go in and edit it, why you would change it. And again, like I said, it brings the film into disrepute. Not that the film had any issues. I mean, I don't know. I don't see the point of wanting to go into this and re-fucking open the wounds. You know, and the fact that, no, I'm going to end it here because I'm going to get annoyed, but the fact of the matter is, right, that his daughter went through excruciating amount of pain psychologically through the whole fucking era of this film being released. The fact that it's brought back up and she would have spoke to him and he was like, I'm editing this, I'm editing that. I just think, like, just leave it, you know, just leave it. But I think that's an old man syndrome, isn't it? You can't fucking leave things alone.
Right, okay. So what? Yeah. So let's just ask the rest of the panel. What do we think about, you know, what's the issue with the film? Because I think you've touched on kind of what the issue is with like the recent re-edit, and then let's also kind of just remember that the film hadn't had a massive issue on its release, right? Like this film has not been loved since forever. So what do you think about this?
I think it's definitely a lot sillier than the other two Godfather movies. A lot of people mentioned that before I watched it. And like, I agree with like the helicopter scene that we like mentioned is definitely one of the sillier scenes. I thought it was cool, but it felt like weird in the context of like the other two Godfather movies. And also when that guy gets killed with a poison cannoli, that was fucking stupid.
He will make really a comeback funny, in one of my
but
lists.
It's dumb.
What about the guy who gets killed with the glasses?
Yeah.
The legend. Yeah. And I love that the change in the third one is in the re-edit is that there's like a geyser of blood exploding after his stomach with the glasses. I mean, in a way, it's kind of what Coppola always wanted to make, because he always wanted to be someone who made European art house films with a bite. And he kind of became a more traditional Hollywood filmmaker after making the first Godfather. And it feels like after that, he always tried to go back to those European influences with, like Jack mentioned, Rumblefish and One from the Heart and all the others, more highly stylized and artistic features. And so it's interesting to see him go back to something that made him famous and popular. And just having this clash of the two identities of him wanting to diverge from that style of classical filmmaking, but also making a sequel to something that's very much in that same vein. And I do think that even reading a lot of reviews and stuff, I do think that the main two problems are the script and unfortunately Sofia Coppola. I don't dislike her in this film. I think she works. It's something that I can see a lot of people laughing at, but if you're already invested in the story of Michael, even a relatively weak performance doesn't necessarily ruin everything about the film and the emotions. And I find it interesting how all of Coppola's career, I mean, there's Patrick H. Williams on YouTube who's made a couple of essays on him, but also other people who analyze his career as well as his personal life and how the movies represent something from his life. And so the fact that in The Godfather Part 3, he has this elderly man and he has his own daughter playing the man's daughter, the whole relationship between the two of them can be seen as a direct link between Michael and between Coppola and Sofia. And it's interesting. It's fascinating. I do think it is very convoluted. Like, it's easy to get lost in all the names. I remember even watching the first one with some of my flatmates last year, and they were just kind of like, I cannot keep track of any of the names. And having seen the movie 10 times, it wasn't something that I really kind of I mean, I could understand it, but I didn't feel it. But watching The Godfather Part 3 for the first time, I was kind of like, okay, that's a lot of new names to remember about characters and stuff, and the Vatican and the priest. And it just keeps going. It's like, okay, I don't know what's going on here right now. But I think the emotions are true. Are true to it themselves, are true to the film. They ring true. It's very emotional. It's very powerful. And I do like the change in the ending. I do like that the re-edit is titled The Death of Michael Corleone. I didn't actually see him die. But, you know, he's dead inside after what happened to his daughter. He's dead inside.
So can I just say one thing as well about the Sofia Coppola thing? Because I feel like I'm going to be a big defender in her court here. I think a lot of film fans, and this is general audience as well, have an issue to contextualize character in film. And it's an issue that happens in horror a lot. When like you're watching a horror film and someone goes, oh my God, I can't believe that person did that. If you contextualize it, there's a fucking man in a mask chasing around a house with a knife. You're not really going to act normal. You've got to contextualize stuff like that. Like you've got to just either accept it and not let it bother you, or contextualize it.
But that's the armchair quarterback syndrome, right? People say, yeah. Oh, why is she running upstairs? Like, you'd shit yourself in her position.
Exactly. Oh. Look, exactly. That's just a reference. But the Sofia Coppola character here, like, she's meant to be a 17, 18, 19-year-old teenager who has a lustful relationship with a man she sees as someone who is a hierarchy.
Which is also her cousin. Let's just put it in perspective.
When she sees Vincent, Like, it's an interesting conversation on power play and dynamics.
I mean, it's Andy Garcia. I'd bang him to it, but, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a fair player. I mean, a Cuban playing an Italian is controversial in its own right. I'm sure Nick's got something to say about that, which, again, was ridiculed when it first came out, which I don't think is a fucking issue, to be honest. But, yeah, she has a lustful relationship that she sees someone who ultimately is trying to emulate her own father. And there's an issue where she looks up to her father to a degree where nothing that he can do is wrong. Whether, you know, when you see her brother and obviously Diana Keaton's character portrayal, they see things in a very different light to what perhaps Sophie Coppola's character does, because that's a father. Like, you know, there's a relationship there that's different. I think if the film explored that to a greater degree, I think that Sophia Coppola's character and the performance itself will get a far less bashing online or online, but within the industry, within the medium. She's a very young girl who in the film itself hasn't seen much of the world. She has been given everything that she's wanted in her life. They're a very well-off financial family. She is cocooned into into a family dynamic that is not normal, that is projected as such. As normal, should I say?
Well, yeah, because they mentioned that the sort of the scene where Fredo got killed, or where there was a shootout in the second one, and they kind of, it's almost like they gaslit her into thinking that this never happened.
Exactly. If that was the dynamic of the undertones of the film, that was the thematic way, this film would be absolutely outstanding, because it's got a core emotional value there.
It's there. It's very subtle. It's there.
Yeah, but I think you've got to reach for it, though, to be fair. It's not in abundance. And that would go so well in a secular relationship that happened with Michael and Fredo, mm-hmm. about trying to detach his family from his life, of which he was unable to do 20 years ago. I think that's very, very interesting. I don't know. Alas, that's not what the film's about. But I think once people try to contextualise Sophia Coppola's character, I think it's far better. The other thing I want to talk about as well is that it's what Alina said, where she said the film's quite silly. I could not agree more. There's a character, Joey Zaza, right?
Yes.
A year later...
He gets his ear bitten off, by the way.
Mike Tyson style. Yeah, he voices Fat Tony in The Simpsons, mm-hmm. which anyone our age grew up with. Every time I hear Joey Zaza, that's the Simpsons character. I cannot detach that.
That's not the character, that's you.
No, granted, but it does ruin my experience personally. He talks literally just like Fat Joe, or Fat Tony, whatever his name is.
To me, the silliness
I don't find that credible. I don't find it credible. I don't find it immersive. I'm like, that's a fucking Simpsons character.
See, there's to me the silliness. I mean, just because you just touched on this, I just wanted to kind of bring this up because it's in my notes. This, you can kind of take it as silly, but I kind of think it works. It's like Andy Garcia is putting on an impression of young James Caan. Yeah, for a reason, because he's his son.
It feels sunny.
It feels like he's just hot headed, and he does this, like he bites his fist, and he's just
he's always screaming.
And he's like, when they're like, it's a hilarious scene when he goes and meets Joey Zaza or whoever in with Michael, and then he shouts, and then just Michael is kind of like intimidated by him because he just has no idea. Like, and Connie is just shouting in the back. It's just ridiculous scenes these people write. But I wanted to kind of jump to the defense of Sofia Coppola, because, you know, she's my girl, and I'm what I wanted to say is she's fine. She's a young girl, yes. And also, we have to remember, she's an inexperienced actress surrounded by Al Pacino, Diane Keaton, Talia Shire, Andy Garcia, and then God knows who else.
Keaton Wallach.
Yeah, top people. And then, like, in comparison, you'd look like hot garbage.
I was going to say, while I was watching both versions this morning, it just feels like Sofia Coppola was just really intimidated by everyone else that was around her. She's all right with Andy Garcia, but like her scenes with Al Pacino especially, I was like, sweetie, you don't need to be so afraid of him.
Well, maybe
I just really felt that.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, It's just a very not to interrupt you, because I know you're going to make a point, but I feel like there's just so much going on here. Like what Nick said about character names, like John Savage turns up here. Like what is he doing here? And then you've got like Ray Fallone, who's a villain in the Italian Job, pop up, and like again you've got Bridget Fonda. Like these people just show up and add nothing in the very big names. Again, it's like,
but this is
Eli Wallach again. Like it's like there's it's most definitely if I'm making this, I want my cast. I want to make this with who I want. And again, it's that ego it runs through. And again, like the Vatican thing that's trying to emulate the John Paul scandal with the poison.
Well, it's not emulating it. He's doing it in every single film, that he's writing these stories into the American history, into the history at large. Mm-hmm. Like he's doing it to American history beforehand, but he's doing this to just regular, just normal history. So he's kind of just making you feel like this is part of the real world.
Like Cuba in the 50s in the second one.
Yeah, they did it in the 50s. The whole premise of the first one starts because these mafias, they rose during World War II, right? And then Al Pacino comes back from the war. He's a hero, right? So it's almost like you can't escape that the history is part of this. So I think it's fine.
Fair enough. But if the film had wanting to sort of maintain the ideology of like what the first two do, specifically what you said about the second one, let's spend some more time there then. Let's get indulgent. Like we're going to Courtyard. And we'll talk about we get introduced to Michael's diabetes. It's like, okay. And then we get a bit more character, but we never spend enough time there to be indulged in that world. Whereas in Cuba, you have it as a background, but it's integral in one certain scene with Fredo and another scene with a character, I can't remember his name.
In Rothman Hyde?
Yeah.
Rothman something.
Hyman Roth.
Hyman Roth.
Like you are. Yeah, it's a strange name, but you get indulged into that world and its background, but it's also integral in sequences that then you become established to like understand and identify with iconography. The Vatican here is like vastly underutilized. Like one major component of the film where you could fucking get rid of that in the edit, and you could really bring it down by 40 minutes.
See, I was thinking that I could agree. I used to agree to the fact that it's like, oh, there's too many names. It's impossible to follow everything and then know. But you don't have to. Like, all you need to know that these guys are going to go after Michael, and Michael's going to go and take them out. That's it. And then that's pretty much all you need to know. It's kind of like in the first one, you can get intimidated by all the sort of family names. Like, these are the Bartinis, these are the Solozzos, these are the whatever. This is Luca Brasi, but he works for us, but he sometimes works for them, but he really works for us. It doesn't matter. Like, all that matters is that you have a shoulder to hang on to, and that's kind of fine. But to me, all these names and the fact that these are all sort of actors that you recognize, it kind of adds to the feeling that you're watching an epic. This is like Coppola, I think he's purposefully working in the same sort of headspace as like Sergio Leone would be working in like Once Upon a Time in America, or even in his westerns, that these are supposed to be epics. Like every way you turn, there's going to be a face you recognize. So that you kind of feel, it kind of adds to the scale almost. Because there's no longer just a small drama. The small drama is kind of just somewhere there, but it's a big, massive drama. And then also, you know, it has its own problems. But to me, like my issue with this is something I wanted to kind of say is Al Pacino, actually. I want to say Al Pacino is I've rewatched all three for this because it's always a good opportunity, right? When you meet Al Pacino in the first one, he's meek, but he's not like he projects this sort of meek appeal, but he has a brain working behind it, right? But he's young and he doesn't have the voice yet. Like he sounds very nasally, right? He's very sort of like young Al Pacino, like in like Serpico or in Dog Day Afternoon, didn't have the sort of voice. In the second one, when he goes into the, I can't remember what the guy's name is, but he goes like, in my house, you know, like he just shouts at him and he has this sort of Al Pacino gravel already in there. And then in here, he's almost like ridiculous. So he's almost like,
Just smoking dust to you.
Like, you know, in Heat, he's almost just on the sort of apex of this, that he just fell off a cliff right after that. That he's kind of just like, great ass, you know, like this, that he's he's kind of already kind of just lost his shit in there, and I think he's kind of just getting there quite close in there. He's in already this sort of in this mode, and it's almost difficult to kind of take him seriously because I at least found him scarier when he would be silent. Like in the first one, like say when in the first Godfather, when he has the first confrontation with Kate, when he tells her, one time I'm gonna let you ask me what I do for a living, right? And she asks, and he lies. And he gets angry at her, but he doesn't say anything. And the second one, he gets angry at her and he shouts and he beats her, right? And then so he's almost just loses this sort of grip on him, his persona. And I think this kind of adds to the fact that you don't take him seriously anymore. He just says things. He's like an old grandpa who just says things. Like he's just like, Uncle Michael doesn't have his meds right. Don't worry. Like, so, I think he's part of the issue for me that undercuts the film a little bit.
Again, Jakob, don't you think that's an interesting thing that we're all trying to suggest, is that even though the film is, 2.5 hours, the running time, the edit, does not give any credible and substantial depth to remotely any of the characters. Like, I think your point is so valid, but I think what you would say otherwise is that we got to see that prolonged and we got to see that him descend into the way he is by the midway throughout the film. If that was an hour in, let's say, maybe even 2 hours in, we're going to go Godfather to part two standards. I think you have to slowly and be intoxicated, let's say, with lack of a better word, into that descent, like you are the second one and like you are the first one. It feels like this film is vastly rushed because of its production history. I think that's a major issue here. And again, I just don't think either edit solves that. There's one really tender, beautiful scene where they go back to Sicily, right? And he's showing the old town, and he shows her the picture of his first wife who died. And you just think, like, I could spend 25 more minutes here just seeing them romanticize each other. When she's in the car and he pops up in the driving seat and he has that smile when Michael was at the wedding in the first film. There's a cheekiness to it. There's a charismatic nature to Michael.
Was that smile? He just had a broken jaw then.
No. Before I think they had a broken jaw at the wedding. Come on. You watch these films, didn't you? But you get to see that bounce, that emotive core. And you're back into it, pull me back in. You all jokes aside.
I thought I was out.
I thought he was opening the podcast for a second. I thought you paid his cameo.
They put me back in.
But when you see them,
I was driving home and I was practicing this. I'm just driving down and then just trying to kind of just weave in between people just queuing for petrol like fucking assholes. And I'm just like looking at people and just like, just when I thought I was out.
Jesus. But when they're in Sicily and we get to see this iconography again, exactly what I was saying about the first film and the second film. You feel the power, the core of where this film is set, the tenderness, the character, and he just pulls away to go to do a Scorsese subplot of someone getting shot by a fucking shotgun in a car, and that's not. I mean, again, if that's the era that he's trying to emulate, fair enough. But every time he cuts away to something that's a third party to the plot that commences and ultimately runs parallel to the finale, I find myself finding it boring. Not just not boring per se, but I find it to be underwhelming. I really like the film. I'm trying to give that impression, but I just get you watch this man.
Like you got to poke holes because why are we going to just talk?
No, fair enough. But you see a man very quickly descend into having a conscience, which I think Al Pacino's on record of saying that he doesn't like what Coppola did in this film. And I think when you see, like you said yourself, when you see Michael's trajectory from the first and second film, this one feels weirdly out of place, and it is that descent where it just happens, that's it. And I just find myself thinking, well, if you just give it more time, more flavor, and let it develop, I think again it would be a far richer experience. Again, I wouldn't have made the film. Maybe that's the issue.
I think it's still rather effective, maybe personally at least, the whole descent into having a conscience. I found that there would be plenty of scenes that just linger on and focus on him, on his face, just trying to find redemption of sorts for his soul. I didn't really feel like it was, I mean, not, there are some moments that are definitely rushed. There's some moments in the script that make you go, why is this here? I love, for instance, that this kid is kind of like, I want to go study singing. And the next scene when he comes back, he's like, I have my opera that I'm leading. he's just leading an opera now in like a span of 1 month, maybe even less.
He must be a great singer. Right?
Like Jesus, I guess. Know.
I mean, I have a whole
that's nepotism again. just that made me laugh. But in general, I didn't have many problems, honestly, with, especially after rewatching the previous two ones. I didn't have that many problems with them, with the character arc. Anything, I think the theatrical version is way too many scenes that slow the pacing down. I kind of like that it moves.
First
a bit
communion
quicker.
That just takes forever in the theatrical, right?
Yes.
So that's a convention of the franchise, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I know it's a convention of the franchise, but if you think about the films, let's just say 155 minutes long plus credits, right? So in the first one, which is 3 hours long, when it starts with the wedding, it's already...
Are you sure it's 3 hours or is it not 250?
257, 57.
255,
okay.
Something.
So, but it's half an hour longer, right? So you can say that when they spend 3 minutes at the at the song at the, so you kind of get the wedding sort of atmosphere, and then like you can, I don't speak Italian, but I can only imagine that these grandpas, they're dirty bastards, and they just talk and all about sex because they go like and point the finger, and it's just, you know, like, and all the kids are listening. I'm like, fuck, you know. but you have the same sort of situation in the third one. It's just the film's half hour shorter. So he kind of, it's a bit weird.
I'll tell you one thing that, like, and again, I think it's an issue where the Sofia Coppola thing and the Robert Duvall issue, it arises and it takes much acclaim away from what's left in the film. And the one thing that I've always felt, who never, ever, ever, ever got the acclaim she deserved, is how good Talia Shire is here.
Oh, so good.
She is incredible. She's so good. She is the heart and soul center of this film.
Okay, she's just underrated across the board.
She has that DNA. She's sidelined in the first. She's sidelined in the second. And here,
she's not sidelined in the first.
She's a serving part of the narrative, but she's a sideline.
She's sidelined in that. I think she's in the first one. She's just asked to be hysterical.
She is a sideline, but here, a brother finally gives that character from Coppola himself, and Talia Shire just takes it, and she's outstanding. And she's got like a quite predominant part of the film. She's ultimately becoming like what her brother is meant to be, in a way. Like she's putting all the pieces of this jigsaw behind someone's back together. Mm-hmm. She quite clearly sees, I mean, again, the film doesn't really bring much attention to it, but she sees her brother falter. And she understands that Vincent has to be that next person to take on the thing. Again, that's brought way
it's
too
also
early.
Take way too quickly, way too early.
Yeah, exactly. Agreed.
But I mean, you can understand that it's symmetrical to the first one because Michael ascended to the throne very quickly as well. Because he just took care of business.
On running time, do you think it's as quick as this? So, like, would you, if you had to guess?
Well, no, it's trickier because in between there's this whole, they go to the mattresses, they go to war, and then he goes to Sicily and gets married. But,
oh no, I don't mean contextual. I mean general in running time.
In running time, I think it's slightly quicker than in the first one.
Okay.
Yeah, but what I will say is, one thing I have a problem with Talia Shire, and it's not with her performance, but with the character, how she's written. Is I don't understand why, because she seems to know everything. Like she's now just in on everything. Like she's like, oh, I know. Let's kill this guy. Fucking like she just stands behind Andy Garcia and goes like, yeah, fucking kill him. Like it's just why? And then she knows that Michael ordered for her husband to be killed, even though he lied to her. She knows Michael killed her brother. Like why is she agreeing to this? Like what?
She knows they were in the wrong after all.
First and foremost, Jacob, she's a bad bitch. Well, first and foremost.
But she seems
she
like an
what was coming she to could, him.
She could run that fucking family with her eyes closed. And to be fair, it gives precedent and credence to the fact that Michael may be the manufacturer of evil, but that doesn't diminish the fact that his inner circle will know or eventually know everything he does. This is a close-knit family. They deal in absolutes. If that's to kill his own brother, he'll do it. That doesn't surprise me that she would find out about us. Doesn't he fucking tell her that he ran off her husband? Like, she was going to find out, surely. Like, it's not, I don't think it's out of question the fact that she would find out about this information. I do agree with the fact that she takes on a considerable amount of responsibility in this film that feels like we don't have any sort of information preceding that for her to be in the situation she is, because pretty much pushed out in the first and second one.
Well, no, in last time we see her is basically just before Fredo gets killed, right? So you don't even know how she reacts to this. Like, you don't know. And then all of a sudden she's in on everything. Like, what the hell?
She's also the last Corleone left together with Mike.
You know, I think we need a prequel comic, guys. We need a prequel comic.
Well,
filling the gap.
Speaking of prequels and whatever, like, there's always the Sicilian.
I've tried to do that. I've tried to do the director.
I'm not sure if the film's connected in any way, but the book is.
Like, no, the book they had is... to edit it all out, didn't they?
Hmm?
They had to edit it all out.
Yeah. So
that's a fucking good gem. That's available on YouTube as well.
A Sicilian?
Yeah.
I mean, we might as well, like, because that's an interesting one to get into, especially that Cimino has massive problems.
It's just nice to see Christopher Lambert get work.
Yeah, fair enough. Yes.
The only time this has ever been said by someone.
I mean, that was at the brief moment in time when he was just doing stuff. Like, he was the Tarzan, he was in the Highlander.
What was the best one film he made? Is it Subway?
Oh.
The what?
I'm pretty. Christopher Lambert was in a Luc Besson film. I think it was Subway. I think he made it before Nikita.
Uh-huh. I think you... Hold on.
I think I know I'm right. But
I think please. you may be correct. Maybe. It rings a bell.
Maybe. Can you not give me the absolute? You're not just
no, I'm... Hold on. I'm fact-checking you.
Fact-checking me. Wow. Food for thought here, guys, because Alina's just eating something and it's reminded me to say, did you know that I read this, because I've got a Godfather companion book, because we're geeks in my family. Apparently, in 1989, when this film was meant to be geared up, apparently Robert De Niro begged for the role that Andy Garcia played.
Really?
Begged. And was almost cast in it, but they didn't want to pay to age Michael Corleone again throughout the film to an even older level.
But that would have made no sense. Like, no, this would have been a bad idea.
And God, he didn't go for it.
I mean, it's bad enough that you have to kind of get used to young Robert De Niro doing essentially a Marlon Brando impression, right?
Oh, whoa. Don't be blasphemous here.
No. I like it. I like it, but it's kind of like...
He won an Academy Award, Jacob.
I know he did. I know he's
good.
I like it, but there's... Think about this. Marlon Brando is not Italian, right? So he was putting on a character. Like, some would say now would be, let's just say, maybe cultural appropriation. Because he was just putting these like cotton balls,
give
and, he
it to
like,
him.
No,
and he found a cat on set, and he kept him.
I think by his volition, he wouldn't accept the Academy Award for the first film because of the industry's discrimination against.
I know
Native Americans.
I know all that. But you know, I think about this. So he was already putting on an impression, right? And then you have young Robert De Niro trying to play a riff on this impression on how this character would have been when he was younger. And it kind of feels like you have to adjust to it because it's not Robert De Niro at all. Like, he could just be himself casual because he has the Italian swagger to him as well. He could be himself. No? Is he Irish or is he like Michael Fassbender, like Irish German?
I think he's got Irish roots, but I'm pretty sure he's Italian Irish.
Yeah,
I think he's the Irishman.
His dad. Have you ever heard about his father?
No.
His father, Robert De Niro Senior, mm-hmm.
Is he Robert De Niro Jr.?
Pardon?
Is he Robert De Niro Jr.?
Yeah.
Oh.
Robert De Niro Sr.'s father was an incredibly talented artist in New York, but would never sell his or showcase his work. And it came out that when De Niro was beginning to formulate his career as an actor, his father came out as gay, came out of the closet. And his artwork was sort of like recontextualized. And there's a really good documentary about it. It's only about 55 minutes about his father. And he's incredible dynamic he had with him. Like, they look spitting image. And you talk about the power of art form, where you have to recontextualize something and, you know, what it means on a personal level after you find out more information, which is always interesting, I suppose. But then when you look at De Niro Jr.'s his performances, it's always like he's trying to escape from who he is and wanting to, like, project into something else. I've always found that really interesting, Robert De Niro's dynamics. That's, I think that's why he is able to go to. And I think, again, like, not to steer off to Robert De Niro, because he's like, I was in America when he came to Halifax, where I live, and I almost lost the plot. I was close.
So you could convince people that you and Robert De Niro are the same person because you're never in the same country.
Well, I didn't say it.
Just saying.
But they said I'm wrong.
No, but like what I wanted to say is just, yeah, there are bits of the film that are kind of just, yeah. I think Alina, you put this over, they kind of are silly that way, because it kind of feels like there are decisions being made just for certain things to look almost intentionally cliche. Like, I don't know. It's just weird that way. And then, yeah. Andy Garcia is just like the top, although he works for me, but it's kind of like that. He's almost like a parody.
When you said the film was silly, like, I'm generally, because I think I know my answer, but I'd find it interesting for yours. Do you think if this film came out now, do you think it would be meme to fuck? Do you think it would be that silly to the point where people would be like, have you seen this?
I don't know if it would go that bad, but, like, I feel like Italians in general are a meme right now anyway. And I feel like if, like, people always make this hand gesture all the time as, like, a meme. You know the hand gesture I'm talking about, listeners. And, like, I don't know, specifically the cannoli scene, people would meme the shit out of that. I'm surprised it's not a meme, because that's hilarious.
But see, there's also symmetry, because it's like, oh, leave the gun, take the cannoli, right? That's, you know, like, it's always...
Cannolis are the gun.
Well, they are.
Yeah.
But it's kind of ridiculous when you see this guy just going with this cannoli and he's just mouthing, like, he's singing along. It's just ridiculous.
He loves the cannoli.
And then for some reason, for a second, I thought, like, did they actually poison the cannolis? Like, what's happening? And it's like, oh, okay, we did. Okay, good.
Like, it's taking a while to take
effect. It always sort of, like, it always fucked me up when I was younger that, like, Charlie Shire, some of it. And I was like, what? Did you not, like, have any effect for that then? Like, did
she,
you
like,
not...
flicks a bit of it? Like,
yeah, but if it's
it poison, looks like she pretended to take a bite out of it.
Do you think?
Yeah, like, because you would think that there would be, like, whipped cream or something on her lips, but there wasn't. So, like, she just tricked the old dude into thinking she bit it, but she didn't bite it, actually.
Plot twist.
There's no whipped cream in the cannolis.
Whatever the cream is. Ricotta cheese. I've never had one.
Ricotta cheese are so good. I'd die for those cannolis. You know, it's worth it. It's sweet to death.
I love how, Niccolo, you're westernizing, because you're not saying ricotta, you're saying ricotta.
They always do that. It's like, it's hard for me to say the Italian names because then people don't get them.
Mascarpone.
I've only had cannolis one time and they were vegan, so I don't remember what the filling was. So it's definitely not ricotta cheese.
Tell the story about the meatballs, Nick.
What?
Tell the story about the meatballs. You, this Italian connoisseur of food, tell the story about the meatballs.
Meatballs aren't even Italian.
We got some meatballs one day. We had leftovers of good meatballs, and Jack came over and I was like, I'll give you lunch, Jack. I'll give you meatballs. Bullshit. I'll reheat them. And they were like tuna meatballs and sausage meatballs and meatballs. I don't know what else was in them. And Jack didn't like them.
That's not true at all. I told him after of a fucking heavy day of being piss wet through with sweat, I said to him, can we go to the fucking bakery or wherever to get a sandwich? He said, I've got some food at the flat. you can just have it there. So me thinking, right, he's going to treat me here. I'll go back because I've got some meatballs. The same meatballs he talks about taking to screening rooms being delicious, right? So we go to this room and he opens a fridge and they've got what looked like fucking fur, but they just had a coating of something on it. I was like, what are they? Different colours. So that's fucking red flag number two right there. Right? He goes, you can eat them raw, you can microwave them. I was like, right, because I would microwave them. So I put them in a microwave for a minute, got them out. We went down to the fucking garden where there's fucking flies and everything. I get a fork, I cut into one, and it's just fucking sand. It's like just sandy material. I went, what is that? And he goes, I don't know. He didn't know what it was. He never asked me if I was allergic to anything. He didn't know if I didn't like it. And it's just fucking horrible sand material. So I ate half of it and it was genuinely fucking grim, right? And I opened another one and it's just this dark brown texture of like meat. And I asked him, I said, what's that? And he goes, I don't know. I think it's beef or pork, something meatball. And I tried it, it was fucking tuna. He had no idea, right?
Tuna is the pork of the sea, okay?
Well, there you go. I don't eat similar people. So I would have really fucked off if you would have done that. I don't like pork. I don't like fucking tuna either. So the fact that it did that really upset me. And we were talking about stuff because I was telling him about some fucking news I had about some films. And I swear to God, right? I swear to God, there was a fly that was eating some of it when I left it. And I looked away. And 10 minutes ago, it was just dead. It was just dead on the plate with his back up.
There's no proof for that. There's no proof of that.
He killed me in a foreign country, and he made me miss two screenings talking shite to him. And he goes, I'll get you a glass of water. Goes upstairs, gets it from the tap in a fucking foreign country, right? And he brings it and he goes, do you want any ice? Well, yeah. So he takes it fucking back up and puts one ice cube out. I said, oh, why have you taken so long? And he says, I've been stabbing it with a fucking knife to get out.
So he had a block of ice. Come on. Like,
what?
I mean, like, it's not, like, you know, come on. Like, it's Venice, not Mogadishu, right? Like, you know, you can drink tap water in Italy.
It's good tap water as well. It's healthy.
I'm sorry. But
for the rest of the lunch, I was just waiting for him to drop dead while listening to opera. Staring at him, just trying a bit of the meatball. It's good, Jack. You can eat this.
Yeah, so I can put myself in Eli Wallach's shoes, and I can fully understand.
Sounds like, Jack, you need to get in the car, drive down south. I'll fix your meatballs. You'll never forget. Okay, like I make mean meatballs.
Can I come
marinara
as well?
No disrespect. I'd want you to make me a proper, authentic Polish dish.
I can. Yeah. Can make you an authentic Polish dish too.
To cook Polish food.
I cook also. So I like Mediterranean food because it's healthier than Polish food. Polish food is very sort of.
Oh my god!
Rich.
That's so you're talking not a Northern about fucking healthy food. I'm putting mozzarella sticks on one dish.
I'll even go the extra mile. I'll make these meatballs and I'll put a little sort of bowl of mozzarella inside and before cooking, so they'll melt.
Wow. Sounds super tasty.
Good at Jacobs, aren't we?
So you know. And Carson thinks I can't cook. It's just anyway, with the cannolis, it's a good way to ring this round to the film because that's something I wanted to kind of gauge your opinion on. Would you agree that Francis Ford Coppola, as from all the movie brats, he has the most in common with George Lucas?
Yeah, but is that positive?
Yes and no. I mean, in here it kind of works, but I think all these three films, I mean, because, well, with the re-edits, it kind of just lends itself to this sort of analysis anyway, that he's kind of like, oh, coming back and then just fixing his films. At least he keeps the originals available, right? At least you don't have to, you know.
Yeah. Do you know what, Jakub? Yeah. To your theory, would you not, let me put this forward, do you not think he takes a bit after everybody? So he starts as himself with the Godfather mm-hmm. stuff. Then he starts to make...
He's like the thing. He's absorbing.
Yeah, then he starts to make the Spielberg type of stuff, like Carlson with Electric Car, and then he makes films like Rumblefish and The Outsiders. He goes to his Spielberg stuff, and then he goes into his De Palma with the Twix and Tetra, and then now he's gone into his George Lucas era. Mm-hmm. And with The Godfather Part 3, it's his fucking Scott says, I feel like he's done everyone's bit of service.
Scott, yeah, I think you're onto something. I mean, what I would say that this sort of the bit of Lucas that I see, it permeates all the way back to the originals as well. As in, like, you know how Lucas always kept saying that, you know, Star Wars is like stanzas in a poem because he just likes the repetition. He likes the symmetry. And there's the symmetry is like all over this trilogy. I think even with the re-edit of the third one, I think he almost made the symmetry almost stand out even more. Because it's so, you know,
on a literal level.
Literally almost like the first one starts with like, oh, Don Corleone, I need your help. Because then there's this guy called Amerigo Bonasera who needs his daughter avenged, right? And then he re-edited the scene from like in the middle of the film to be right in the beginning with the bishop going like, Don Corleone, I need your help. Because, you know, like these guys are trying to buy me out. And then it's just like you're like into the banking plot already.
So, and it works.
Yeah, but it's a bit of symmetry. And then it goes... In the original, it goes then, okay, fine, whatever, do. Like, can I please now enjoy my daughter's wedding because Constanza is getting married, and now you're transitioning into the party where they sing the same fucking song. So it's like he's doing this on purpose just to kind of just make you realize it's just like, no, we're watching the same film. It's just one long 12-hour long film that Alina watched in the span of one day.
To be fair, I quite. The one thing I really do appreciate about the narrative, I like that it ends ultimately where Michael's life, where the Michael Corleone that we know begins in Sicily. Like, you know, Michael has a first life until he shoots the police officers, the police officer and the operating enforcer, and then he goes to Sicily and he's born again, and it ends in a very similar manner where it comes full circle that Michael Corleone. I like that. I like the fact that
in the Sicily bit. I mean, we'll get to it because I wanted to kind of talk about it anyway. But there is this sort of idea that in the second one ends with him on a chair, third one ends with him on a chair, and then also you have this sort of big piece of symmetry, the big set piece in the end of the first one. Nick, you were just, I don't know, painted a poem or a visual poem in the top 100 episode, right? The sort of the baptism juxtaposed with all the heads of the, you know, all the Barzinis all just getting the, you know, they're just desserts. In here you have the same thing, like you have the opera scene, everything kind of just surrounding the opera, so everything kind of crescendos around the sort of a piece of art, and these people are getting off to one by one. So sort of at the same time, it's clear piece of symmetry to the first one, right? And I suppose, yeah, it works, but it kind of also it kind of looks a bit cheesy. In a way, it's kind of like, I know, like, you love the first one. You really knocked it out of the park, Francis.
It feels more like a sequel to the first one than the second one does. In the sense of like how sequels are more conventional in repeating things from the first one with references and the like. I agree.
Even the second one, I mean, maybe I'm a bit controversial in here. I kind of feel like the second one is almost undercut by the fact that it's two films that kind of don't have nothing to do with each other. It's also on, they're all kind of parallel because they're symmetrical.
Yeah. But one's rising, one's falling.
Do you think in hindsight, knowing what happens now with films shot back to back, do you not think the better idea would to be make the Robert De Niro prequel for 2.5 hours, and then a year later, released The Godfather Part 3, which is Michael Corleone's, an ending with Fredo's death and him getting older and that thing. That, in hindsight, would probably more beneficial to cut your losses and say, that's it, I'm done. I think you are right to a degree. I wouldn't. I'm not even going to attempt to dismantle the second film, but I agree with you. I think if you can separate those two entities, I think you can easily make a trilogy out of those three films that.
Yeah,
have although the deeper significance.
Do you know the Robert De Niro? If you separate it, the Robert De Niro part of the second one, I don't think it would be strong enough to stand on its own as a film.
No, I mean you'd have to quite clearly beef it up. Don't get me wrong; you would have to with the latter part of the film as well.
Well, I think it works almost exclusively because it's intercut with Michael's story, because of the parallels, because of how they're taking different directions with. Like one is rising, one is falling, and all of that. I think separating it's going to be very much its own entity in a negative sense, almost like a spin-off. It's kind of like, why does this exist? What's its purpose? Meanwhile,
are you talking about the 30s, 20s, 10s
Yeah, the Nero section. There's the Nero section, yeah.
Do you think the audiences would not accept that?
I think it wouldn't work nearly as well, especially because all of that ties into the final scene, which is the flashback to when they were all younger, before all of the chaos happens.
You know, okay, here's a controversial idea. If this was made today, as in if Francis Ford Coppola, okay, could make something the way we do things now, this would be a 12-part miniseries. The whole thing, all three films, will be a 12-part miniseries, and the Robert De Niro part will be interspersed all throughout the sort of all the three plots.
I can see
because then it ends with, you know, with him going paying respects to Don Fanucci, right? And then just like cuts him open like a pig, right?
He has not done his research because
and that's kind of intercut with Sofia Coppola dying.
You have not done your research because this was made for television. There's a television version of this with added footage.
Well, yeah, but then I can see this like as a 12-hour HBO sort of thing, like, you know.
Has anyone seen the Godfather epic TV version?
I like Bruno Kerber. I like Robert De Niro. I like Al Pacino. I'm not sitting down for 12 hours to watch them mumble.
In one go, 1 hour installments.
No, I'm not doing
it. I did it.
I've just finished.
Yeah, exactly.
Alina,
I did like have 8 hours of sleep in between, but I still technically did it all within a 24 hour span.
See? There you go, Jack. You're a puss.
No, I can't do it. 12 hours.
It's called being committed and having poor planning skills because I thought we were doing this next week.
Alina, how many hours is it? So it's 2:55, it's 3:20, isn't it? And then it's 2.
And there's 2.5 times 2.
Oof, no.
Is this your day of your life?
When someone says TV, I have flashbacks. I just think of Damon Lindelof and J.J. Abrams and Lost, and I swear to God, I fucking shudder. I'll black out for a second and come back. I can't do it. I can't do long-form television like that anymore. I don't want 21 episodes of just people shouting at each other or not doing anything and having a fucking flashback to something.
But that's different because it's self-contained.
Long format should be extended director's cuts of feature films. I don't need 10 hours of a fucking Army of Thieves Zack Snyder thing about. I just think he's got to a point where it's constant saturation and overzealous nature of putting footage to something and feeling like that's adequate to tell a story. I think it just balloons projects that don't need to be that long.
Well, now we're in this room, I might as well just say that I kind of feel similarly about television in general, because it's always been said that, you know, like cinema is the domain of the director. This is where the director reigns. And then TV was supposed to be where the writer is in control, right? But in reality, it's almost never reduced to practice. It's almost always, no, the writer is in control. That means all we have in TV is plot, nothing else. Like characters... Agreed. Our characters are more secondary to the plot because they work in service of the plot, because everything's kind of just sketched out in advance and works in service of cliffhangers and commercial breaks. It's ridiculous. But if you think about this as a 10-hour film divided into 10 chapters, it's a different story, right? Because you have situations like this. You have like True Detective, for instance, right?
But are you saying that with the admittance that this is from Coppola, who we know about now? I think. In that, if a man like Coppola, who didn't know, had wanted to bring this story to the screen, I think you would have more trepidation.
Well, Coppola now, yes, who probably still wakes up covered in sweat after like having nightmares about 1979 and making Apocalypse Now, right? He still has PTSD after trying to shoot Marlon Brando. Well, he just rocks up on the set naked or whatever and just takes a shit on the table because you never know.
Like, that's unconfirmed. Can either say? I get to the point. I don't want to make this a ramble about Lost, but the fact of the matter is that those creators and writers, and this is going to be very personal, to apologize here, but the fact of the matter is that those writers came out and said, "Do you know? To be honest, when we got to season 4, I've got a vendetta about Lost. I need to just clarify that.
Okay.
You know, when we got to season 4, you know, we didn't really know what we were doing, and we just wrote it. Those men should never work again." I said on that fucking review of Cinderella, we need to start stopping people from having a career. Like, the fact of the matter that Damon Lindelof can get a job
Is that why you're such a harsh critic?
Excuse me. I fucking had to spend 18 fucking hours watching Matthew Fox run around a fucking jungle. They're not designed to fall in love with some blonde chick or Evangeline Lilly, right? And then you've got fucking whatever Max Holloway as Sawyer. Then you've got someone else, and they kill fucking Dominic Hannigan off. And then, you know, like, I just get to the point where there's an excessive nature to television, and anytime anyone talks about TV, I just go back to Lost, and I think there are three creatives, whoever were on board at ABC, who had no fucking idea and a shit ton of money. I think it's very dangerous to talk about 12 hours, 10 hours of a project. I don't think anything can suffice that without it being genuinely, utterly boring.
Like, well,
go ahead.
We're talking about The Godfather and everything. Like, I've been watching freaking The Sopranos.
I fucking knew you were going to say that.
Well, of course, it fits right in.
It's a leading question. That's what it was.
Television who've had the fucking guts to say, I'm done. David Chase and Vince Gilligan, they called it when they needed to call it, and it was they crafted masterpieces. But those two people...
But they're also plot-reliant.
Who?
They're also plot-reliant. I mean, are you talking about Breaking Bad?
That's television, as we said. But yes, those two people came into film, then went into television, and then have tried to go back into film. I think that's the difference. These are very different. As you say, Jakob, directors and writers... I think they were crafted as directors who went to be writers. I think they brought that knowledge and that interest of that certain specific field in the industry. And ultimately, the project that they've made flourished with it. But Nick, go on with your Sopranos story to contradict me. Go on.
I think it works. I think it's taking something like The Godfather and other crime epics and translating it to the small screen in a way that's not... It's not boring, shockingly so. I mean, I finished watching the third season right before this call, and I'm very much into it. And I'm halfway through now, so I think I'm going to feel the length of everything. What?
Do you know everything about it?
I only know the ending, because it's hard not to know the ending.
I've never seen The Sopranos, ever.
Don't watch Newark.
I will. I've heard good things.
Don't watch or watch?
No, don't watch until you've seen The Sopranos.
How many seasons are there? Yeah. Okay, I'm also with Alina on this. I also have not seen a single episode of Sopranos. Don't kill me, because I don't have time for television most of the time.
I think you'd love it.
I am planning on watching it after I finish my Supernatural rewatch, which I realized.
How many times have you seen Supernatural, by the way, out of curiosity?
Sorry, I've never finished it. Huh?
Oh.
What?
I stopped
watching around season 10 as it was airing because I went to university and I got busy. And seasons? Then I just like, there's too much, there's 15 seasons of Supernatural. And I just got too busy to pick it up. So I decided earlier this summer to just rewatch it all. And I stopped around halfway through season 4 because I got busy with Fantasia and then TIFF. So next week I'm going to start watching Supernatural again. But yeah, I have 9 seasons to get through before I the ladies at Rian Pictures are all obsessed with The Sopranos, and they've been bullying me to watch it for the last year.
So you need to do it. You need to watch it.
Yeah, it's very good.
I feel like I'd like it.
Out of curiosity,
yeah,
The Supernatural, because I can't leave this alone, but first question, how many times have you seen it?
I've watched the first 5 seasons at least 10 times.
Oh my goodness.
But past season 5, I've only seen those seasons once. Because I feel 1 to 5 are good and they should have ended it there. It's a solid.
I remember my wife was into this at some point, and she tried to drag me into this. I checked out after season 1.
Oh man, if you think
a Supernatural stan. Hold on.
Whoa. I mean, I've seen your Twitter. I'm well aware.
Well, imagine 2010 to 2012 Alina Tumblr.
Yeah, that's what happened to me. I met the entire cast in 2013. I'm trying to find it, but my internet's kind of...
Here's
the
question,
right?
Also, to clarify, as Supernatural seasons, is this Lost seasons or Dexter seasons? As in, is this 24 episodes or 10 to 12?
It's 22 episodes a season. Jesus.
1 hour each?
About 45-ish minutes.
Oh my God.
Also, it's TV hour, okay, because it's that cable, right?
You said you want to watch it because of your wife. My mum and dad, I cannot believe I'm saying this, they had me try to get them. They wanted to watch True Blood, and I'd never heard of it. And I said, "Oh, yeah, you can watch that." So I got up on the television, and they did them all. And it was only until after my dad, it might be after, he goes, "Have you seen True Blood?" Oh my god!
At
that. No.
Just for
listeners
out there. That's in
2013. Alina's just brandishing her photos with the cast of Supernatural.
Listen, you can cut this, by the way, but Jensen Ackles wants to invite me on a live stream. I don't know, can you hear this if I hold it up to my microphone?
Hey, guys. Hey, Alina. Hey, Fatima. Hey,
Jensen Ackles said hi to me in a live stream. I was a fucking stan. I watched all the live streams.
Holy shit.
So, like... we talk about this on Clappercast all the time with Marvel movies. It's the sunk cost fallacy. I have to finish that fucking show or I'll die. So,
I mean, in all fairness, like there was a time that I was dragged into watching, I think that was at the time when there were only 9 seasons to watch all, at the time, all 9 seasons of Grey's Anatomy.
Oh my God. That's what doing at the moment. It looks fucking boring.
Well, I'm no comment.
It's like the True Blood thing that I was like, my dad was like, have you ever seen it? I was like, no, why would I watch that? He's like, I can't believe how much sex is in it. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, you need to read up about it. So I read up about it. I was like, fucking hell.
There's like, a lot of banging.
There's orgies. Like, there's not vampires.
It's, it's kind of like you were trying to recommend like the first season of Game of Thrones to your granny.
No, they've watched that as well.
It's just, there's a lot of, and then it's just like, Gran, you watch this. And then remember, incest is best.
Oh my god, I can't believe you said that.
I can't believe you've done that.
Incest is best.
Medic.
Jesus Christ.
You know, medic.
I don't know.
No, what I wanted to say quickly with the seasons and then TV. It's specific, not exactly with the, I knew the Sopranos was going to come up and like The Wire or something. But what I wanted to say is some. After seeing the Underground Railroad, I would think that a narrative this big works in a TV series if it's disciplined enough to be, okay, this is one story divided into chapters that kind of work in the service of the characters and the story, not in the service of, I don't know, fulfilling an obligation to a TV station. Like these, you know, because, you know, if you aired it on television, it would be like, why is this episode only 20 minutes long? Because it has to be 20 minutes long. That's what it needs.
I've got two things. One's ridiculous, but the first one's true. If you ever read about David Chase, he's a very interesting character in his own right. He said that if the pilot wouldn't have got made, he would have shot 40 more minutes of footage, and it would have ended. I'm going to say this is not a spoiler. This does not happen. But he was going to end it with Tony putting a pillow over his mother's face and killing her. That's how it would have ended. He was going to be able to make a film out of it. That's not the case now, obviously. But, you know, I can, and I hate to say this because it's like fucking a cinematic sin. Guarantee this, I would propose this. In the next 10 years, I guarantee The Godfather gets remade for television in an Amazon-like production.
Okay. They're only doing the film about the making of The Godfather.
Yeah, But fucking Miles Teller can't fucking, you know, he's anti-vax, so.
Oh, they were shooting it, you're right. And he had to stop production.
You know, he didn't tell anyone.
You're right, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, we were talking about
this. This was a year ago, he didn't tell anyone.
A year ago, wasn't he doing...
No, it wasn't a year ago, it was like 6 months ago. And he didn't
wasn't tell anyone. Wasn't he doing Venice that it came out?
Yeah, and it brought everyone to standstill. Like, that's fucking... I mean, I've heard rumours of Top Gun 2, gang, and it's not good, so. Anyway, move on.
So who's master supposed to play? Young Francis?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Really? He can't grow a beard.
As well. Wasn't Arnie Hammer in it?
Yeah, but he was replaced by Miles Teller.
No, it will play Al Ruddy.
Oh.
Yeah, the producer.
So who's Francis? I want to see, because he could, you know... Almost said Ramesh Ranganathan. You know.
I mean to be fair, like
Oscar Isaac.
Oh, okay, he can grow.
Francis Ford like, Coppola.
Yeah,
and
I can see.
And he's Robert Evans.
That's exciting.
Who's playing him?
Oscar Isaac is playing Coppola.
Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. And
Jake Gyllenhaal is playing Robert Evans.
Nice.
Another legend.
I forgot Jake Gyllenhaal is in it too.
So
yeah, it's a good cast.
I'm getting really fucked up with the whole thing though now. Like, can't we have a bit like mysticism with this sort of stuff? Like, cinema's meant to be like a format where you get whisked away to a different planet, not a planet but a different world.
Unless it's Blue Valentine.
I'm being like an incredibly like naive and ignorant prick here, but I do like the fact that sometimes when people don't make commentary tracks or deleted scenes, it establishes that thing as being its own entity. I just don't think anyone really needs to know how The Godfather was made.
Medic! Like,
yeah, no, but I just, if the documentary, yeah, Hearts of Darkness by Coppola's wife is a stunning, if not one of the best documentaries ever made. But it feels like it needed to be made for Coppola to look back on that.
Or like that documentary who did this? Niccolo, help me. Who did the documentary about Fitzcarraldo?
Not Ian Mekas, the other one. Jesus.
Why am I blanking on this?
You're meant to be film bros? You're meant to be cinephiles?
Les Blanc.
Yes. No, but like you sound like Jack. I don't want to break this to you, but you sound like your buddy Spielberg. If you comment on the movie, you just burst the bubble. Magic's gone. See,
you two are
alike.
One in the same.
You're like a closet fan. Beneath your red rum little poster, there's a poster for the terminal.
No, I like that film. Regardless, moving on. A clock is right twice a fucking day. Like, I'm sorry. Like, the man made Jaws. I'll give him what he does. But the man also has made West Side Story and not made one comment about fucking Ansel Elgort. To me,
we haven't really seen it yet. I mean, I already kind of have a feeling it's gonna be shit.
Well, I've super heard a vicious good. Rumor that it's 3 hours long.
Well, just there like is. The original. I don't know, the original I saw...
2 hours and 59 minutes too long. Maria.
The original I saw...
That movie's going to be my hell.
You know.
It's no, so it's, good.
I've
never watched the original. I don't like musicals.
It's very good. But the movie doesn't like it then.
You need to be on here more often. Because everything you're saying today, I completely agree with. I need you back on here, so please...
I'll sign up for some more. I literally just get super burned out into podcast a week, though.
Musicals are boring. We need to sit there. They're boring.
Yeah. Like, no arguments there. Like, West Side Story sucks. Hey. And also, it's widely problematic.
Well, it has problems, you know, of the time. You can look past
it's like the sound of music. Like, I find, like, we're going to make a musical about Nazis and stuff like that. Like, are we really going to try to do that? Like,
it's not about Nazis. What the?
Well, the Nazis are in it, but you know.
You're making it seem like a very different film. There's Nazis in
West Side Story?
No, The Sound of Music.
Oh, yeah. I like The Sound of Music, actually. That one's fine.
Same director, you're going to like.
Yeah, a little bit twice. But you know, if Carson finally just pulls his finger out and then re-edits the classic cover, because he'll be able to hear our opinions on this. Because we did this like 3 hours fucking of like, you know, these are a few of my favorite things. But yeah, it kind of overstays its welcome. And I'm watching this and it has young Christopher Plummer. And I'm just thinking, who did he replace?
Right, you know. Look, I'll say this. It's this, someone whoever runs the fucking show, if whoever watched Dear Evan Hansen, right, needs to get a fucking reality check and be like, we cannot make this anymore. We need to put them back. Put them back.
I watched Dear Evan Hansen twice.
Did you like it?
Yeah, no. I went the second time because my musical theater cousins wanted to see it. And I was like visiting them. I really wanted to see Cop Shop, but I got outvoted.
Oh.
Also, maybe we could do like musicals because I like Grease. Yeah. I like Grease and I like Mamma Mia too. And those are the only three musicals I like.
Oh, you've been Carsoned.
No, I liked Mamma Mia before Carson was a huge fan of it. Because anyway, so I like three musicals so far. The rest I hate. Didn't like Chicago.
I don't
like any. Moulin Rouge is fine, but like I just have a rough time with musicals, especially if the songs suck. I feel like I only like musicals if the songs are good.
That's like most musicals, I'd say.
Moulin Rouge.
Well, I don't remember any of the songs from Moulin Rouge. Like, I could not tell you a single one.
90% of them aren't even original.
Yeah. So would The Godfather work as a musical?
No.
I bet you money. Someone actually did a Broadway production of The Godfather.
Blind Spotting.
Hmm?
I would say Blind Spotting's a musical.
Probably
a bit of on it.
Well.
What do you mean, what? It's spoken rap. What are we talking about? It's musical.
Spoken rap? As in rap.
Spoken word rap. I'm just clarifying for our...
As opposed to the melodic rap.
Orchestral like rap.
Boring.
Orchestral rap. Anyway, I think we need to kind of quickly bring this back. I wanted to kind of quickly gauge your opinion on whether the third film gives Michael Corleone the arc that he needed. Thank you.
I feel like this is a very similar thing that Rian Johnson tried to do with Luke Skywalker, where there is quite clearly a conversation that on paper is very interesting, but it all depends on execution. Because if you've seen a character in a specifically iconic way, in a thematic way as well, which is the pure good and defeats evil, you have to really sort of craft substance to make that deviation feel natural. And as much as I think Rian Johnson slightly got it right with the Skywalker thing, you can't have three films which skyrocket up to, you know, being truly good, truly good, truly good. Oh, he's almost touching evil, he's almost touching evil. But no, he beats it and he goes good, good, good. For just being an absolute prick. And I think this film does a very similar way, but in a different thematic, where Michael Corleone is dead inside. He's a man who has his heart beating and that's it. And even then, I mean, there's nothing really ticking there anymore. He has no affection for anything. But it just feels, A, redundant because we got that at the end of the second film, and B, the arc never really goes anywhere. It doesn't ever find any redemption. It doesn't really go anywhere. It just gets ultimately...
Well, he doesn't find the redemption.
That's the point.
He gets punished.
No, I appreciate it gets the point, but like, there's the inclination that when he's at the opera house with his family, that we're all together, we can all be a happy family. But I don't think that, for the ending, which I think is haunting, it's very difficult to justify that with how little, aside from him and his relationship with his wife, played by Diana Keaton, is measured. I think that the film should generally be an hour longer. And I know that's ridiculous.
Oh, no.
TV. It needs to be. Shut up. You fucking sit there and watch it. Don't fucking give me that shit.
It's like Only God Forgives again.
Oh, jeez.
It needs to be an hour longer. I need to meditate with these people.
What would he do for an hour in
talk? That's one of the one films.
There's already padding in this film.
I'm
sorry. Pad. It's a fucking Coppola. It's an event.
I can give you 10 minutes. 10 minutes. I can give you just to kind of stretch out the Andy Garcia ascending to the thing. I can give you 10 minutes, not an hour. 10 minutes. I can.
Well,
give you.
You can have more interactions with Sofia Coppola and Al Pacino. Her with
more Zaza.
I don't want any more Joe Zaza.
I mean, if this went for an hour longer, you'd start asking questions. Why is Sofia Coppola and Andy Garcia not banging yet?
Excuse me. I would never say that. Don't speak for me. I would never say that. I would think that Coppola, with his writing ability, would underlay that with good undertones and strength, of which we've spoken about earlier. So I think he could do that. But again, it's I don't know. The man's made fucking some very strange films, and weirdly enough, this is one of them where you can analyze this to death, and really we're not even touching it. I think this film is fundamentally broken. As much as I enjoy it, fundamentally broken, Jacob, because it was.
Niccolo disagrees.
We'll get into it.
I'm
not the contrarian here.
Andy thinks he's fucking backing a bull here because he's so called Italian.
Hey. Fantastic Italian.
I've heard you. When you fucking drop the accent. You're from fucking North, aren't you?
I am from the North. But no, no I
the North remembers.
North always remembers.
He's from bloody Slough.
But I'll say
well,
this.
It's me, right?
Well, I think it's a good arc. It's a good arc that's needed, I think. Because if first one, Michael, good man, who's corrupt, who's always had darkness in him, and is corrupted by the power and the things that he can get with the power of becoming the Dawn. And at the end of it, he is the Dawn. The second one, it's seeing how his hunger for power and for more control over everyone just destroys his life and brings him to actually kill his own brother. And like you said, he's just without a soul. And the third one is showing you that a man like him, who's soulless, can still have a bit of, you know, still something there hidden inside. And the ghosts of the past, they've caught up with him finally after 20 years, and he cannot escape them anymore. And he's trying his best to just find a way to move on before it's too late. And, you know, it's like a carrot to donkey, just keeps him going a little bit, but in the end he cannot get it and just dies. It's bittersweet, but it's the only way to go. You cannot have him actually, you cannot have the movie end with him like, you know what, everything's all right. He killed dozens and dozens of people. Give him a happy ending where everyone's alive and happy and they're a big, wonderful family. That's the one thing he cannot have. That's the ending of the second one. It's showing him with his brothers, his dad arriving. It's kind of like, he had this, he had it, and he's just thrown it all away because of what? Money? Power? Even he doesn't know after a while.
So hold on, the birthday scene, is that in the third one?
It's in the second one. No, wait, the birthday.
The birthday flashback. To the
second one.
It's in the second one.
Yeah, at the end of it, after he kills Fredo.
Okay.
Because Marlon Brando was paid like $1 million to turn up, but he didn't.
But they never show him.
Yeah. Thankfully.
No, he didn't fucking turn up, that's why.
For the better.
I'll say this, right, Nick? To point. After 10 minutes or a day later after this film finishes, within contextually within the film, what does Michael Corleone do then? His daughter's been murdered. He's not the Don anymore. Vincent is. What happens?
Stays in Sicily and dies in a church.
Just withers away.
No, I think that Michael becomes something else entirely. Michael then becomes, from what I've seen from the first and second film, becomes animal, becomes a ferocious amount of just of anger, paranoia, and just violence, and would erupt, and he would do exactly what his dad never told him not to do, and he would ultimately become what his brother was destined to be, which ultimately killed him, is that he would have a fit of rage and he would destroy everything in his path and he would bring all of New York down with him. That's the impression I would get for him then, for this to happen to him.
So you want him to become the Hulk?
Tony Montana.
No, I mean, like, he's a tactician. He's a murderous, violent tactician. And I would simulate at this point that even after he's what would be the love and light of his life, which is not his wife, it's his daughter. She's pure. She's not involved in any of this stuff. She sees her father almost as a saint, Saint Michael. I just get the impression that he wouldn't just wither away. This is why I would agree with Al Pacino with the interpretation of where the character went wrong. I think that it would be the you know, pun intended, but the gun in the chamber, and he's now got his gun loaded. For him to just wither away at the end, I think it's a cop out. Do you know, for me personally, and then again, I'm not going to tell Francis Ford Coppola what to do, but I am. For me, if you had actual, and no pun intended, I don't mean this disrespectful.
Don't make me go up with
it. You're telling it to the writer of the book as well, Mario Puzo.
The Vineyard.
if this film had any balls or guts, when he releases that scream, I would fucking, and he sees her, and then we get the scream, not I can't remember, cut to fucking black. Leave it all up for the imagination.
We still, that's what I thought it was going to end.
But this would be like the Mystic River.
I want it to cut to black. And it says, Friend Mario Puzo's, The Godfather Part 3, Code of Death Michael Corleone, whatever. For that lingering last shot we will ever see of Michael Corleone, is him screaming in a fit of pain, rage, just emptiness that his daughter has been taken away from him. That's if you wanted the emotional punch, bang, there you go.
Yeah, Brick, but it doesn't give it an ending.
Pardon?
It doesn't give it an ending. It then stops being
That's another borderline. Yeah, it's another borderline
cliffhanger.
Cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's wrong with that?
Because it was supposed to. He wanted to make a coda. He wanted to make an epilogue. Right. That's what coda is. He even says it in the fucking opening in himself. But you know, it needs to crescendo and it needs to calm down.
I like that you only see the daughter in the flashback of the two of them dancing, and you just see the others.
We can maintain our own viewpoint of the ending.
You're wrong.
Also, as well, I don't even want the fucking re-edit thing as an entity anyway. So scratch that. If he wants a code or not, he should have put it in 1990. Unfortunately, not now. I'm not even accepting that as a thing at this point.
Oh no, you've seen this in the scene before. You have the opera. You see it how opera ends. Operas don't end on the you have this crescendo, everything comes together and people calm down, and then you have a smaller piece to kind of just calm the nerves of everyone. There's the epilogue, there's the coda to an that means this whole thing is an opera. This is operatic. Epic, great American epic.
Yes, and the last piece of music is from the actual opera. It is from Cavalleria Rusticana.
Yes.
Even though it's the interlude, but whatever.
Well, yeah, we don't have to get into this. Yeah. But no, what I wanted to kind of just quickly just add to the sort of Pacino's arc. I disagree with the fact that he's corrupt, I want to say. I mean, not more. No, he is corrupted, but he's he does his darkness.
Michael Corleone.
Yeah, his darkness is weird because you can see it all throughout. That what does he always want? What does he want? He doesn't power. Want power. He doesn't want power.
Like the Oracle says in the Matrix Reloaded. What do you want?
Oh, fuck off!
All men want more power. Educate yourself. Come on.
Take another shot.
There is no spoon. Fuck off.
Yeah, I saw that, Lena. That's heartbreaking.
No, it's funny. I didn't mean it as a dig.
Yeah. You know, every week, like he just goes like, "Welcome to the desert of the real Jesus." Wake me up when December ends. I'm sorry.
The first film.
Every week.
Almost there. You're almost there. Yeah, could be a tweak it.
He's
not corrupted.
He's not corrupted. No, the darkness power. He has. Like, think about it. He doesn't want power. He doesn't want power. He has this sort of Machiavellian sort of thinking that ends justify the means, and the ends are to keep the family safe. So he looks up to his dad and he sees, okay, well, he's always about the status quo. He needs the family to stay the way it is, and he can't cope with the fact that his dad's dead, that everything kind of just falls apart, and he has to, and you can always see that he's rationalizing. He's never, almost never acting brash. He loses his temper once when he hits Diane Keaton. Right, when she says it wasn't a miscarriage, but it was an abortion, right? So
it kills his own brother. That's not
yes, rationalizing that he needs to do this because he threatens the family.
Yeah,
he's not.
Plato had what's coming to him, and yes. I stand by that. Yeah. In the words of Vin Diesel, you don't mess with family.
Exactly. I'm watching like this. I'm watching this. I'm thinking like Vin Diesel. Watch this. This is the ultimate family saga. It's all about family. Yeah. It's family.
I've been waiting to make that joke the entire episode, by the way.
Brilliant, by the way. Well played. But all he does is always like when you see in the, for some reason I thought it was in the third one, it's maybe in the second one, the sort of birthday scene when they tell him, or when he tells him that he's in the army. I'm contextualizing that the corruption and darkness comes from the fact that he doesn't really factor emotion into his decisions. It's all based on this one sort of principle of family has to stay on top, and it doesn't matter if the brother comes.
Isn't that by virtue an emotional thing, though?
No, I think it's he thinks I understood it when I saw the sort of birthday scene when he's when they all talk about how people just sign up to the army, and he signed up to the army to the Marines, and he says, "Well, I just did," and then he never says why, but you can understand that because that's the right thing to do. He figured that what's the right thing to do at every step, and he does the right thing. Like if the right thing to do is to go and kill a guy and a police commissioner and then go to Sicily, that's what he's going to do. If the right thing to do is to take over a company, that's the right thing to do, and he doesn't care about, and then only at the very end of the sort of trilogy he realizes that in doing so he's not fixing the family, or he's not keeping the family together, he's ruining it. And then he realizes it when he confesses, and by the way, it's a ridiculous confession because he just gets absolved of murder. What kind of Catholic Church is weird.
If I remember correctly, his reasoning, which is implied in that scene you're talking about, is he joins the Marine or he joins the army to fight World War II because of the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that rational? That's an emotional, irrational decision based off an event that's happened. Like, he's not rational, Michael Corleone, I don't think.
No, he is rational.
He's trying to distance himself from the family as well. Like, you see that clearly in the opening of the first one, where he's kind of like, I'll never be like them. That's the whole tragedy of his arc. It becomes what he didn't want to be.
And he wants to, at all costs, his overarching thing is he wants to keep the family together to turn it straight.
Yeah.
Like, he wants to use his power to kind of just close the criminal books and everything, but in the process, he has to kill, like, half his family.
It kills his fucking sister's husband, granted, who probably deserved it, I'm not going to lie, but, like, out of an emotional, irrational decision that
an emotional, irrational decision. It's months in advance, and he also told the guy when he went to him, you're going to be fine, here's a plane ticket. It's all planned. It's all premeditated. It's nothing brash about it. Nothing, everything's, it's cold. He's like a
Canadian, like you said.
I will say this, not to digress, but I've never had a fucking as good as what Al Pacino's orange juice looked like in this film at the Vatican.
Also, how quickly they gave him the juice.
They just had it on standby. The colour of it is like, I can just see it now. I've dreamt of it. Like, I've been multiple fancy places. I've never had a fucking orange juice that looks like that.
You live in Halifax. There's no sun in Halifax.
No, there's Tropicana and Sunny D and stuff, but have you seen the colour of it? That's orange
juice.
That's what they named the fucking fruit after.
That's cinematic colour grading. It's the power of cinema.
I think the colour, the name of the colour comes from the fruit, no?
Yeah, that's what it said.
Yeah.
But I did the ironic thing where I twisted it.
Right, okay.
I've heard to explain this sense of humor now.
Before we digress into what came first, the orange or the color orange, I think it's a good time to close this and say, how about we go around the table and then exchange our final thoughts on The Godfather Part 3 or Coda or Death of Michael Corleone. Alina, do you want to go first?
I liked it, but I feel like it was not necessary. Either the original part three or the recut. I feel like the story of the Corleone family just wraps up fine with part one and two. So, like, I'm happy it exists, but it definitely, like, feels like an epilogue, which was his intention. So, but it's not necessary. But I had a good time watching it.
All righty. Who wants to go next? Final thoughts. Jack, do you want to go first?
Yeah. I hate Lost. I hate musicals. And throughout this podcast, I've noticed that the more I talk about this film, the more I cannot agree more with Alina. I like that we have this. I'm glad it's here, and I will watch it in its entirety with the first and second one. However, fundamentally, I just don't think it needed to exist. It needed to have existed. Did? Yeah.
Did it. Grammar is fine.
I hate you, honestly. I hope your Mrs. bollocks you after this call.
She did.
Yeah. But I just, look, I wrote my review of it when Cody came out. I'm a I'm a big fan for the issues that this film has. I really enjoy Sofia Coppola's performance. I think Andy Garcia is really good, although a lot of it does start to depend on parody almost, and it does become like a little silly, like Alina said, and it comes out of an era where it's clearly influenced by Goodfellas and Scorsese, when in actual fact, you know, Scorsese influenced by the house that built it. And I think there's just an issue that you can't really get over that fact, specifically as a Scorsese fan. I just don't see why the edit needed to be made. If that's to appease his sins, you know, fair play. But I see it more so as a money issue and a money thing to raise funds for this new sci-fi film. And if that's the way he can do it, fair play to him. But I just, you know, I keep on going back to it. But you have two excellent films, and the fact that this was made purely out of a financial need, and not necessarily one that was out of love and adoration for the material. I think that's the issue fundamentally where this film goes awry. But it's here to stay. We've got two versions of it. I think both of them are pretty good in their own right. But, you know, compare it to the magnum opus, and you're a long way off, I think. But nothing that sort of sustains any issue with for too long. It's quite a good little ride.
I personally really love this film. Even talking about it during those 2 hours, it's been, I don't know, I just appreciate it even more in some ways. I do like that compared to many others. Like, in a way, this is almost the first, I would say, major delayed sequel to an acclaimed film. Like, you know how we got to Sin City or The 300 and all those that took 15, 20 years to make. I do like that this one is one of the first to have the same cast, the same crew coming back to bring it to life. And watching the movies back to back, you do feel it feels fitting. It feels consistent. It just fits, even with some of the ridiculous moments, which are undeniable. My lucky jacket. I cannot believe it. It's my lucky jacket. Just all those moments. Sure. But it's, like Jakub said, it's a coda, it's an epilogue, and it's a fitting one, I think, both in the film, in the context, but also the film as a whole. So many good things about it, even some of the weaker aspects, not worse, but just weaker, like Sofia Coppola, they still manage to work. They're not to the detriment of the film in any way for me. I love the cast, I love the music. We haven't talked about it, but Nino Rota and the other Coppola, they do a amazing job here. It's so good. Yes. I love the soundtrack to these films, and here it's still wonderful. I love the way it's shot. They still got the chiaroscuro going on in the cinematography, and it's just a pleasant watch. Just so much weirdly fun, and yeah, I like it more than the second one. I really do now. Official.
These are bold words.
Yes.
I'll put it this way. I'm close to kind of being in a similar boat, although I think I appreciate the second one more, but the second one, just the running time, it kills me.
Tracks.
It's just too long for its own good. It's just tiring. But I think the third one keeps growing on me. I mean, I was like a 3.5 out of 5 back in the day on this. Now I think I'm more like 1 star more even on this. It's honestly, I really like this film. I love it in a way that, although you kind of have to qualify this, that this is not a film that you can just put on. Like, I can't take this off the shelf and watch it. This has to be part of a rewatch of the entire trilogy. This film does not stand on its own, I don't think. And which is, I suppose, it will be a, you know, like a knock against it, right? But it is, yeah, because it's a coda, it's an epilogue, it's an epilogue to a longer arc, and you can't just forget about the arc unless you just have the previous two by heart, which I suppose I kind of do have. But yeah, I like the performances, I like the music, everything kind of just fits in there for me. Even the corny things, which we'll get to in a second, they kind of just, it fits. It's an operatic sort of crescendo, and the sort of the takedown of like all these emotions are shedding, and then I like the what Coppola did initially with the theatrical cut. I like what he's trying to do here. It's all a bit more dreamy, and I'm super happy that this film exists, even though it doesn't I don't want to say it doesn't have to exist, because that way the second one ends on a cliffhanger, and I'm just, it's just weird for me. It just feels, the second one feels unfinished. It feels like the main story is kind of just there, but it needs an extra chapter. And then I think this is this chapter, and it kind of helps that also it's not 3.5 hours long. So yeah. So yeah, that's me. How about we go through our top threes? Alina, do you want to go first through the top three moments of The Godfather Part 3?
Oh shit, I forgot to do that. So I do you want that was a segment.
Do you want someone else to go first while you prepare?
Okay, wait. I really liked the helicopter scene. I thought it was fun. I liked all the silly shit. I liked the cannoli scene. That made me crack up. I don't know if I have a third one, so come back to me for my third one.
Okay, so meanwhile, just think about your bottoms.
Yeah.
Jack, top three.
Top three. Oof. I think Andy Garcia as Vincent is probably one of the best turns of the film. I think he quite clearly loves the material. I think he appreciates what he's doing in the film. It's venomous. It's ferocious. It's very charismatic. I think it's splendid, especially contextually from where his character's lineage is from. I think it works extraordinarily well. I'm going to make a statement here, and then I'm going to contradict myself later. Just let it go. Please let it go. The other arm, I really like Sofia Coppola in this film. I think she wonderfully.
Does the record show that this man said that he doesn't like Sofia Coppola in this before?
Did I say that?
Did you? No. Who did?
I did.
Oh, Nicholson. Sorry.
Wow, that's the host, ladies and gentlemen. That's the host, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd have said that 10 minutes later, you might have a point, but. I think again, she plays wonderful naivety really well here. I don't think it's consciously, but it plays into that role. And again,
who cares if it's consciously?
Yeah, well, I think there's a factor that she doesn't know how to retort very well, and she becomes very internal in conversation. Like Lena said, like she's almost afraid. It comes across like she's afraid. But I again. If you listen back to it, I think we have made some really good points of it. And lastly, and this is a specific I like, that final sequence where she turns around, and I've said this on the fucking podcast every time I get a chance to say it, where she turns around and all the sound turns to diegetic sounds, and she looks at him and she says, and the camera pans down. No, it pans back to him. No, it cuts back to him and it cuts back.
And pans down.
She says, Dad. And the camera pans down, and there's the bullet wound in her stomach, and she just falls. The fucking scream that he makes, which I've heard conflicting reports that they had to re-edit. It was so like difficult to listen to. It was harrowing.
Could you imagine if they had actually re-edited a Wilhelm scream in there?
Well, don't ruin such a poignant monologue I'm going on. Thank
Sorry.
You.
Okay.
You already mixed me up with another guest. Disrespectful. But the fact that the noise he makes and how it just ricochets in my mind, I find genuinely haunting. It's so well captured and curated from Coppola, the sound design, the costume design, the set. It's just one sequence in the film. And granted, it's a good film, but not compared to the other two in terms of set piece, where it floors me. And those would be my top three.
Oh, Alina, do you have your third one?
Well, I agree with Jack that Andy Garcia was pretty good, so I guess that'll be my third one.
There you go. Okay, I've got a bunch of these. So, okay, I'll say it's definitely... hold on. Nick, did you go? No, Nick.
No, you can go. You can go.
Okay, for a change, I might as well
break the cycle.
Okay, I'm gonna say Andy Garcia in general making an impression of young James Caan is brilliant. Also, when Andy Garcia, in the sort of meeting with Joey Zaza and Michael Corleone, and then he just Connie stands behind him and he just says something like, "Right, right," and then like, and just as he's saying this, the camera's on Al Pacino and he jolts like.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Like he's just scared of this guy. It's just amazing. I mean, like, in all seriousness, like, I try not to bring like like massive general thing, but this is kind of like multiple scenes that kind of just work towards the theme of this elements of symmetry, especially in the coda, the re-edit, they kind of work so much better. There's just the juxtaposition of the killing and the sort of baptism, and now just now it's in this sort of opera sequence. The opening song at the party is brilliant. It's all kind of just makes, like, you watch this and you kind of just think like you're reliving your own memories, even though it's just films you watched. So it's so it's kind of fun. And with all that, it's also kind of just another sort of slash the sort of elements of real history kind of in the film, like the John Paul the First sort of, you know, the election of the Pope, which is kind of also symmetrical to the Fulgencio Batista sort of overthrow of in Cuba in 1959, I can't remember now. Yeah. So it feels like an American epic sort of set in real world. And it's just brilliant. Yeah. So Nick, go next.
Well, since we're breaking cycles, this is the first time where I don't have the top three ordered. I just have a list of things because I was like, I don't know what to put in the top three. Because like you mentioned, we have the climactic montage during the Cavalleria Rusticana, which like hats off to Walter Murch and the other editors for doing a banger job putting all of that together. Love the opening celebration because it's always good to have an Italian party and people just singing and losing their shit over songs. I love the scene in Sicily where Michael and JK are just reconciling, just walking together and making peace, kind of amends, you know. It's nice, it's tender, it's quiet. Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in scene, again, classic.
Our true enemy has yet to reveal his face.
Who did it better, me or Pacino? Sorry.
Oh, the guy from Goodfellas. No, wait, from the... It's in The Sopranos, actually. Like, that scene is, like, repeated multiple times in Sopranos. Oh, one guy makes this impression. Yeah.
Steve Van Zandt, yeah.
Silvio.
I thought Pacino was in this call in the beginning. I didn't know what was going on.
There's also, we haven't mentioned, Scorsese's mother makes a cameo in this film.
Oh, I was thinking, is this Scorsese's mother?
I wasn't sure if that was her.
It's her.
Was it actually her?
Yes.
Nice.
Okay, good.
We mentioned the helicopter massacre. I kind of find it funny how the violence in the first two films is very realistic and very brutal. In a way that's also very, I would say, borderline uncomfortable because it looks very real, if you've ever seen footage of violence and blood. But in this one, it's very exaggerated. I love the heat on Zaza during the parade. It's so fun. It's just this massacre in the parade. And then just Victor Zsasz is at the door and Andy Garcia was on the horse the whole time. It's just inspiration, kind of like,
for the Dark Knight.
Zsasz shoots him. I was like, yes, sure, why not? Inspiration for the Dark Knight. Yeah, I can see that. But no, I'm copying from everyone.
That's such a fucking reach.
The moment where he's confessing his sins. I love the death of Mary and the use of Cavalleria Rusticana intermezzo. Awesome. I was just like, all those are very good. All of those belong in the top three for me. I was kind of like,
you're like more and more like me. Like whenever I come to top threes, I've got like seven things. So I have to.
When the movie's good, it's the first time. I was like, it deserves it.
Trait going through him on this podcast where he can't fucking do the rules at all. We did 100 films, right? And we all had to choose one. We were told that. And when we get to our number ones,
Don't spoil it.
Fair?
Everything who'd ever made?
David Lynch. Is that fair?
That's cheating.
No, rules are made to be broken.
Because we were afforded cheats. So you could cheat. You can have one cheat, as in like something that's not a film. And then you could have three instances where you can put more than one film, as in the idea would be like a trilogy. Like Star Wars trilogy, yeah. Right? Yeah, so he used both of his, like one cheat and one the composite, and just like, everything David Lynch ever made. And I'm like, fucking weird.
Yeah. Even Dune.
Sure, why not?
Dune's great. Like, I saw it in the
Dune has a total soundtrack.
I saw they put it on Crave, so I might watch it.
It's good.
I might watch it before I rewatch Denis Villeneuve.
It's more fun than the Villeneuve one.
Bottom three? Alina, do you want to go through a bottom three?
Okay, I feel like this is difficult because I forgot to prepare this and everything is like a blur after watching all four movies.
Understandable.
I disagree with Jack, and I did not like Sofia Coppola's performance. I thought her death scene was so embarrassing, and I was like, Jesus. Like, this did not work for me at all. I really didn't like it. And I think she's really bad at flirting with Vincent. And also, there's something very, like, I know it was like a last minute thing that she got cast, but it is so weird that, like, essentially Francis Ford Coppola cast his daughter in an incestuous role. If you think about it, it's a bit odd. Also, it was short notice. I didn't. Yeah, I know, short notice, but it's still weird if you think about it.
You're fine. You can just. We're not gonna ask you to bang him.
When. Yeah, and then when Vincent Andy Garcia bites off that guy's ear, I didn't like that. I feel like it. His character is like obviously hot-headed and like bad-tempered, but I don't think he's like crazy or insane, and that just comes off as like unhinged, and I don't think that works for his character.
Also, there's something wrong with this moment in the scene, as in like it feels odd, like the music cuts out and it's just weirdly edited. I don't know if anyone else noticed.
It's just because of the we're gonna get. Restriction.
I thought of another one. There's a part in Sicily when Sofia Coppola is taking pictures of like Al Pacino and Diane Keaton, and she's walking backwards, and it looks like super green screened. I don't know. If
She's out of focus. The car's behind
focus. Yeah, it was. It looked weird. Didn't like it.
Okie dokie.
Focus puller fucked up.
Yeah.
He got fired.
But the whole trilogy is kind of just full of bloopers. Like in the first one, they had this sort of weirdly ADR line, like I talked to the Barzinis, and then it's just this one line is kind of like from a different role almost. It's just odd.
Actors. We don't have the guy anymore. Yeah. You can do it, you can pull it off.
Yeah, it's very odd. Jack, bottom three.
Right. I don't like the helicopter sequence. I feel like it's way too out of tone for the film, although I can appreciate why it's in there. I just think the thing with Joey Zassa as well, it's everything he did in there just annoys me. It's the accent. But it's just fat Tony at Simpsons. I just want someone to bang your door or whatever he does. that's my impression of Homer Simpson compared to Al Pacino.
Anyway, golden principles.
A third one is, and again, this is just a personal format. I don't think the film is long enough. It demands another 20 minutes. Right? And moving on, I'm going to contradict one of my first points here, but I'm going to do it within reason. And it's not just a follow on from Alina. I also don't think Sophie Coppola should be in this film. Oh. As much as I like her in it, I just think it's so unfortunate for her to have what is essentially a shit sandwich. Like, she's just, it's going to be an absolute nightmare if it succeeds and if it fails, which either aisle you land on, it just doesn't prosper whatsoever. I think the fact that you could have put Bridget Fonda in that role because she's just used to nothing in this, or push production back and try to get Winona Ryder again, or anyone from that sort of era, would be more preferable, and to shoot around those sequences, which is very clearly possible, rather than put the strain under his daughter. And that's generally for her sake more than anything. But those are my three issues. I know they're not like major, they're just personal issues, but there's three things where it's always annoyed me.
It's just nitpicking. I mean, nitpicking is fun anyway, because it's kind of just forced you to look. But then do you actually think that Winona Ryder would have pulled it off?
Yeah,
because like I remember her from.
She's not Andy Garcia's Dracula. Cuban.
See, I remember her from Dracula, and then she's so wooden. She makes Keanu Reeves look like Marlon Brando.
That is fucking blasphemy what you just said. Then moving on, because that's
Keanu Reeves and Dracula is not good. Let's be honest.
I would completely agree there, but she's a really compelling actress.
If there were more of them, they could be a forest. They're so wooden, like fucking hell.
Oh my god, stop. Stop. The interesting thing about what Godfather Part 3, which should be in someone's positive, is that this is a reason why Dracula was made, because Winona Ryder had fallen out with most of the crew. I think someone, they don't ever admit who it was, but someone quite high up in production, who is not Al Pacino or Diane Keaton, was very much against Winona Ryder, sorry, very much against Sofia Coppola playing that role, and demanded Ryder was in or they would quit. I don't know who
is
that
it Andy is. Garcia?
I think it could be, to be fair. But Winona Ryder would be excellent then. I remember that she had fallen out with Paramount and issues here and there. And to make up to Francis Ford Coppola, she actually took the script of Dracula to him and they decided to make it. That's why she's producer of the film.
The reason I'm saying Garcia is because they don't seem to have good chemistry.
What?
Although this could be also part of the character because he knows this. Like, you're like cousin. Jesus, like you're trying to bang me. Well,
Cause. Yeah, and I agree with Alina. It's quite a forced relationship.
Okay, I might as well go next. And Nicole, you're gonna finish. Okay, I have a few that I kind of like. I couldn't decide whether they're top or bottom, so I'm gonna start with them. The geezer who eats the cannoli and sings along to the opera. I don't know what to think about him. Whether he's top or bottom.
It's an upper tier to everything.
He's like the guy who's being poisoned, and he's just eating the cannoli like an animal. And another one is when the two thugs come to Andy Garcia's house to kill him. Right. When they take the stockings off, one of them looks and sounds like Donald Trump. And it's just, I don't know what to think about it. And it just looks like they got Martin Sheen. Because Martin Sheen kind of looks like Donald Trump a little bit.
Does it?
Just a little bit. Anyway. So these are the ones that I wasn't quite sure. Okay. I've got a few that are just kind of character related. Like the fact that Andy Garcia ascends to the throne almost in 10 seconds. Like, just, yeah, kiss my hand. I'm like, really? How Connie's in on everything, I just still can't buy it. Like, all of a sudden, she's just,
God, Jacob.
She knows everything. She knows, like, oh, Fredo's dead. Fuck him.
She's a bad bitch, and she's running the show. You need to get over it.
Well, she needs to get over being married to Rocky Balboa, maybe. I don't know. Plot twist. She didn't die. There was a spiritual death. It died to me. Yeah. And also, when Kay forgives Al Pacino, like, fuck off. Like, really? Like, she had an abortion because she hated him. And then she knows he killed all those people. And she's like, oh, we're fine now. Like,
been 20 years.
She's like attending the family functions in a family that she's no longer a part of. I'm like, really? So
she's the mother of the children.
Well, yeah, it's just like, I don't know, it just feels weird. And then one thing that was just another thing that which just kind of comes back to writing is like when Bridget Fonda's character, after banging Andy Garcia, he goes and blows all these people off, like he just kills them in cold blood. And
well, you might manage to rephrase that. Sorry, what does he do?
Okay, blows them away. Well, I don't know, we didn't see what happened in there. So he kills all these people in cold blood and he comes back to the bedroom and everything's fine. And she's a journalist, right? Like, what? It's just like, well, how shit are your job? At your job, are you?
And then she's gone from the movie.
Like, she's like, yeah, she's gone. And she's like completely nonplussed. It's like, you just killed all these people. Oh, it's justifiable homicide. Don't worry about it. Like, it's just what? So, yeah, these are my bottom six, I suppose. Nick?
Similarly, I don't have the list. But like we mentioned Sofia Coppola's acting, I will say the main problem was the upper lip for me. She's like this constant upper lip. Just constantly like raised.
Do you know how much hate mail this woman has gotten over this?
I feel bad for her because again, like we mentioned, she's not a trained actress. She wasn't supposed to be in the movie. It's not her fault. She just did what she was asked for. Like if her dad is Coppola, you're gonna do whatever the fuck he says. He's the godfather. Just, yeah, master. Just bow down and do the movie and get two Razzies. Jesus, poor woman. Imagine getting two Razzies. Only Razzies for this film. Everything else got an Oscar nomination. Anyway.
Nothing wrong with getting Razzies. Look at Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
I thought you were just going to say, like, The Shining.
Holly Berry's won one, hasn't she?
She has.
Didn't Sandra Bullock win one the day after, the day before she won a fucking Academy Award?
No, yes, that's still...
No?
She's still the... She's still Halle Berry. It's still her, Halle Berry. There was a mosquito, sorry, I got distracted.
Wait, sorry, what the fuck just happened then? We were on about Sandra Bullock, you're on about Halle Berry. What happened?
It was Halle Berry who won the Razzie after winning the Oscar, or vice versa. Monsters Ball and the Catwoman.
I'm pretty sure it was, wasn't it Sandra Bullock with a blind side in that stupid film, she remember Bradley Cooper?
Maybe both.
Wait, Catwoman came out in 2004, Monsters Ball came out in 2003.
Hey, I don't make the rules. Go to IMDb.
You check online. Now, fact check this. If I'm right, I'm going to fucking leave this call. Because you mentioned the Kinney file.
Okay, Sandra Bullock.
Look at Jakob fucking...
I'm checking Halle Berry.
I'll check Sandra Bullock. I'm on IMDb. That's the most trustworthy source. So, Razzie. 2010, All About Steve.
There you go. I know Halle Berry, Razzie.
True, but it was also Halle Berry.
Halle Berry got her Razzie and 25th Golden Razzie, so that was 2005, so that would be for 2004.
Eddie Redmayne also. I found a list of everyone who's won an Oscar and a Razzie.
Okay.
Eddie Redmayne. Oh, my God.
Yeah, for Jupiter Ascending.
Well, let's move on.
No, we're going to get to it in 2 weeks' time. No, 4 weeks' time. Don't worry. Geez. We're going to get there.
Anyway.
No. Let's clarify. Was I correct or not?
You were.
Oh, Monsters Ball was 2001.
Thank you.
Are you leaving the call? No,
It's Sandra Bullock who won it back to on the same year. She's the only actress to do it.
I keep thinking Monsters Ball was like later.
You make it look like it's an achievement.
No, it is in its own right, isn't it?
In a weird way, it is. Anyway, speaking of weird lips, Al Pacino's plastic surgery is very distracting, especially watching the films back to back, because it doesn't look the same. It really doesn't. And in the 90s, it just lost.
What did he have for his surgery? Like, did he just have a facelift?
Yes.
He had a facelift before Heat as well.
Wow.
Well, it got worse between this one and... It got like in the late 80s, after Scarface, I think he got plastic surgery. And then he got it again in the mid-90s.
It's because he's a heavy coffee drinker, a smoker, and he has insomnia.
Oh. I don't like the extra scenes that are in the theatrical cut because I don't really add anything. And watching the two cuts, I cannot honestly tell what was cut, which is never a good sign. I don't like the flashbacks to the previous films in the theatrical cut. Because it's kind of like showing moments and Fredo again. It's like, we don't need them. We know. We've seen the other two movies.
It's like flashbacks to the original Jaws in Jaws the Revenge. Sorry.
Yes. It's just kind of like, why? We've seen it. We know what happened.
Shit.
I do love Tommy just going from wanting to be a singer to becoming the leading man of an opera. That's just okay. Plot convenience.
Great
you
career.
Underestimate the talent of the musical, whatever he is.
You underestimate the political pull of the Corleone family. That's
yeah. It. It's like, oh yeah, become a tenor.
And everyone's tenor. Kind of like, he's shit, but let him sing.
And lastly, the subtitle translation not that great for the Italian parts. And there's a couple moments where they just completely change what they're saying. I haven't written down anything, but they like say, to completely different things.
That's really annoying when that happens.
Yeah. It's kind of like, come in. It's like, yeah. He's dead.
I watch Bollywood movies with my Pakistani friend all the time. Like, we Netflix party them. And she's always like pauses and she's like, yeah, you didn't say that. And I'm like, can they just fucking think, translate things like how they actually are? It's really frustrating. But anyway, that's a conversation for another day.
Yeah, I understand abridging longer quotes to something shorter. I can get that. But just completely changing the sentence, because like, why? But yeah, but the subtitles, honestly, the translations in general in the whole trilogy aren't that great in the subs. But it is what it is. Coppola is not a real Italian, I guess.
Well, Okay. The Godfather Part 3 is available to stream on Sky Instant TV in the UK, but only at the theatrical cut, I think. The Coda, on the other hand, is available to stream in the US on Paramount Plus. So if you're one of the five people who are subscribed to it, go nuts.
Hold on. Wait, I have something to add there. Yeah. I don't know if it's the same in the US, but I got the free trial of Paramount Plus to watch all these fucking Godfather movies. And like the third one doesn't work. Like if you click on it, it just takes your 404 and I have to rent the third one on iTunes or Apple TV or whatever. I was very pissed off.
Oh, so Paramount Plus.
And I like Googled it and apparently they removed it. It's on Showtime now.
Okay.
I read that on Reddit, but yeah, the first two work fine on Paramount Plus in Canada, but the third one does not. It's there, but you can't click on it. So
ridiculous. I don't know if that's a thing in the Paramount US. Plus is
I was mad.
No,
there's nothing on it.
No wonder no one subscribed to it.
Yeah.
Anyways, you can also rent and purchase this everywhere, and it's on Showtime, as well in America and in Canada. And it's also available in physical media, so the theatrical cut is best picked up as part of the Coppola restoration box set, and then the with loads of special features. And the Coda is a standalone release. I'm not sure if it's part of any box set as of now. So I think this is it for this episode of the Uncut Gems podcast. So where can we find you all on social media and everywhere? Where can we find your work? Alina, how about you go first?
I am at Alina Falls on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. And I also co-host Clappercast with Carson and Paul a lot. And so do a lot of things for Rianne Pictures, especially their podcast, Not Having It All. So you should listen to that too.
Fabulous. Jack, where can we find your ramblings?
You can find me on Letterboxd and Twitter with the username at Jack Luke Sharp. But I'm warning everyone, like I did last week and the week before, whichever is, don't follow me if you're an MCU stan. If you're an actress or an actor stan, don't do it. I'm not into it. I don't want to see it. Just follow me. You just tweet often and you talk bullshit. I'm into it, but don't fucking follow me. It's MCU this, MCU that, or Star Wars.
On the other hand, Jack Luke Sharp, as Jack Luke Sharp, has vacancies for Matrix stans.
Yeah.
So everyone you're going knows, to follow.
Always social welcome. Club, 8 p.m. Saturday.
Nick?
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at NickyGirl97 and the Letterboxd Nicolo Brasso. You can also watch my short films and videos on YouTube and Vimeo at Enjoy the Movies. And you can listen to the Death by Adaptation podcast and read my other stuff on Book for Thought.
And also, if you're a Marvel stan, you can go and follow Nick because he takes everyone.
Yes, I'm a very Christian man, you know, open arms, everyone's welcome. Well, no, Marvel stands don't know. There's a limit here
for me. Sorry, I'll take you.
That's
I'll
where
take
I draw you the
Marvel
line.
Stands. You I'll can join you. Me. I like Marvel, unironically.
There you go. Go
I like
follow,
a lot of garbage, unironically, actually.
It's way to advertise it. Okay, and you can find me at Talk About Film on Twitter and Jakub Flash on Letterboxd. And you can also read my stuff on Clapper when I write something that's good enough for Clapper, and on flashonfilm.com when I write anything else, which is usually not good enough. And you can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram, I think. We're still on Instagram, but I'm failing miserably on Instagram. I'm sorry.
Sad.
At Uncut Gems Pod is the place. Twitter is probably the best place to follow anyway. So like, retweet, rate us on Apple, fucking Jesus, and 5 stars or more. If you know, 4 stars or less, I'll find you. I don't know where you live. If you want to get in touch, send us an email at uncutgemspod@gmail.com. So if you want to sound off about The Godfather Part 3 or Coda or the death of Michael Corleone, then this is how you do it. And then you can also support the show with a one-off donation at ko-fi.com/uncutgemspod or subscribe to our Patreon over at patreon.com/clapperltd, where, you know, for $2 a month you get at least 2 podcasts. I mean, I'm saying 2 podcasts, but September is a bit of a weird month. I mean, there's still like stuff in the, you know, be patient, there's shit's coming. But yeah, you get classic Clappercast, you get all sorts of stuff, and then you will very soon, hopefully, as you're listening to this, hopefully the top 100 of our favorite films is already online on Patreon. But it's a 5.5-hour recording, and then there's a joke I need to edit out in the middle of it, and then, you know, I don't know where it is. Yeah. So that's why I have to comb it with a fine tooth comb to find it. Anyway, sign up to our Patreon for all this beautiful stuff and content for $2 a month. Anyway, and so you can tune in next week. We will be talking about what we're doing. Oh yeah, James Gray's Ad Astra. So yeah, even though it has been released relatively recently, I think it already needs some kind of a reappraisal and much needed love, because it seems like people have forgotten it exists. So look out for that. And for now, I hope you have a fabulous day, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.